in the Department of Human Settlements. You are welcome with your team, and I think it will be proper for us to just take a brief introduction so that we know who's here amongst us today. Otherwise, the agenda of the meeting, we've got three items, I think so. The first one will be, I would propose that we start with the National Treasury, because they've got another meeting here in Parliament that they have to attend, as well as the department is going to brief us on the cooperative housing cooperative policy, as well as the whistleblowing policy. The National Treasury, we have invited National Treasury to come and brief the portfolio committee on the regulations that are governing the advance payment to the service providers. Initially, I'm not going to get into details, but we had a reason for that, as we are overseeing the public funds if they are utilized in terms of the regulations as well as the legislative processes are being followed. That's the reason why we invited the National Treasury, because we'll find that at some stage the department, most of the departments, in fact, not department, most of the departments, they will choose to take to use the National Treasury instead of utilizing DORA as well as the Public Finance Management Act. Yes, we are aware of the fact that they do have that responsibility obligation to do that, but I think it is important for us as the members of Parliament to be aware on what conditions are those national treasury regulations are used. So it is important for us, so that when we play our oversight role, we must be clear of what we are overseeing. And as well, we did have some challenges. I think we have shared with the National Treasury in the letter what challenge have we have in terms of the implementation of the sanitation program. So we wanted clarity on those issues, but we are not going to discuss those issues. We are going to stick to the presentation of the National Treasury. The other issues are going to be dealt with the department that we oversee. So I will request the members, with your indulgence, not to engage in other issues. Let's stick to the presentation and engage with the presentation and get clarity, and then the other issues we'll discuss together with our department. With those few words, you are all welcome. Let's just make it quick. Let me start by, where's the member? Mamandobe. Let me start by yourself, introduction.
Apologies for coming late. My name is Makosa Zanandobe. I'm a member of this committee.
Roy Bula, member of this committee.
Archibald Friedland, member of the committee. Sanbona.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Butch Stein, member of the committee.
Good morning again. I'm Gloria Bowman, a member of the committee.
I think we can start with this side. National Prison.
Ulrike Ruida, National Treasury.
Can we get a black key parliamentary life in National Treasury?
Freeman Nomvalo, the accounting general from National Treasury. Sabana Zulu DG, National Department of Human Settlement.
Good morning, my name is Noliko from the National Department of Human Settlements, Randall Housing.
Briefing about Human Settlements Policy
Sector. Mwangeli Shabango, Special Investigations, Human Settlements.
Zaleka Sokopo, Human Settlements.
Kumutila Khalifali, Human Settlements.
Morning to Dixon Lundson Policy Unit, Human Settlement.
Yemeko Mbengo, Human Settlement.
At least now we know each other, now we can address each other better. Mr. Nomvalo, let me thank the National Treasury for responding to us. We know that you are very busy, but we also appreciate that you are willing to cooperate or to work with us as the members of Parliament, and we request that you convey our message and appreciation to the DG, as well as the Minister, yeah, the DG, because we have requested yourself from the DG. So I think I have to apologize because we are starting a little bit later, and I wish to commend the committee members by a progressive decision to take the meeting. I was busy with the office of the House Chair, so I think it is important to apologize officially. Thank you very much. Over to Mr. Nomvalo.
Thank you, Chair. I also want to thank the committee for allowing us an opportunity to respond to this question earlier. Unfortunately have to also go to the Select Committee on Security and Constitutional Development. A little later this morning, there are pending questions that I've been tasked to respond to by the Minister. I did not prepare a presentation, Chair, but I will take the committee through the various provisions quickly. First and foremost, the issue of advance payment is an issue that is regulated in the context of the Constitution as well as the Public Finance Management Act. Now, it is important to, before addressing this question, to first understand the responsibilities. I see some committee members are carrying the PFMA. You can go to page 45. You can go to page 45 because I'm going to refer to a few parts there. It's important to understand first the responsibilities of the accounting officer in relation to this issue before going to the issue of the prepayments themselves. In section 38(1)(a), the PFMA prescribes that the accounting officer must have a system of, let me just quote directly, it says that the accounting officer for a department must ensure that that department has and maintains effective, efficient, and transparent systems of financial and risk management and internal control. So there must be controls in the department. That's the essence of that. I jumped the part around internal audit, jumped the part around procurement, appropriate procurement and systems for evaluating major capital, and go to B. B says that the accounting officer of a department is responsible for the effective, efficient, economical, and transparent use of resources of the department. So there has to be transparency, there has to be economy, so there has to be probity in the manner in which the resources of a department are utilized. The third part that I want to refer to in this part of the legislation is paragraph C, subparagraph 3 at the bottom of page 45, which says that the accounting officer must take effective and appropriate steps to manage available working capital efficiently and economically. And I'm just going to explain that in a short while. Managing working capital, amongst others, the first paragraph there, the first subparagraph, they collect all money due to the department, is part of managing your working capital. But on the other side of managing your working capital is to ensure that you've got sufficient cash available to meet the obligations as they fall due. So as and when invoices come through to the department, you should have sufficient money to make those payments. So and part of the things that people do in this instance is avoiding prepayments or delaying payments as far as legally allowed. Now, you cannot delay it beyond 30 days in terms of the PFMA. And then the last part that I want to refer to under the accounting officer's responsibility is that the accounting officer of a department must comply and ensure compliance by the department with the provisions of the PFMA. So I've listed just a few things that have to be there, but the last thing that must be noted here is that it is important for an accounting officer to ensure that everybody in the department follows the law. And by the way, just as a side comment on this, is that accounting officers in fact should ensure that executive authorities comply with the law, because you have the responsibility over the resources of the department. So that responsibility lies with the executive authority, with the accounting officer. When the executive authority may, under rare circumstances, I don't think executive authorities do this, but under rare circumstances where an executive authority may issue an instruction that is inappropriate, then the accounting officer should then ensure that there's compliance with the law. Hence, the provisions in section 63, 64, and 65 of the legislation that deal with the executive authority responsibilities. Now, it is important to have that background. And then coming to the issue of prepayment, the issue of prepayment flows in part from section 7(1) of the PFMA, which is in around page 17, 18. But basically, what that section says is that the Treasury must prescribe a framework for cash management. And then chapter 15 of the Treasury regulation has got that framework. And in chapter 15 of the Treasury regulation, that framework is covered and deals, amongst others, with the issue of prepayments. The paragraph concerned here is paragraph 15, 10, 1, 2, 15, paragraph 10. How do I call this? It's 15, 10, 1, 2, C. So that's how we find it. The main paragraph is 15. The sub-paragraph underneath that is paragraph 10. And then the sub-paragraph is 1 and 2. And then C. So that's where you find it in the treasury regulation. What that says? It says for the purposes of this regulation, sound cash management includes, remember I said this is the framework prescribed in terms of section 7.1 subsection, section 7 subsection 1 of the PFMA. For the purpose of this regulation, sound cash management includes avoiding prepayments for goods or services. And then in brackets it says that is payments in advance of receipt of goods or services. So you can't pay unless you have received that which you're paying for, whether it's a service or it is some good of sorts. And then it says unless required by the contractual arrangement with the supplier. So you're not allowed to do it. The only circumstance in which you can do that is if your contract with the supplier obligates you to do so. Now, when entering into that contract, bearing in mind the responsibilities of the accounting officer, you need to assess the potential risk in relation to a specific service provider or agency that you're supposed to be paying in advance. You need to assess the risk and take a view in signing an agreement that obligates you to pay in advance. So it is the accounting officer's prerogative, but also the accounting officer's responsibility to make sure that when he or she enters into an agreement that obligates him or her to pay in advance, he has satisfied himself that that entity will not make it impossible for him to meet his obligation. Now, I need to then pause back and go back to that page 45 of the PFMA here, to that page 45 of the PFMA, and just point out that 381C2 says the accounting of the decisions must take effective and appropriate steps to prevent unauthorized, irregular, and fruitless and wasteful expenditure and losses resulting from criminal conduct. So I'm coming back to that after having talked about prepayments, because when you sign an agreement and then as a result of that agreement you have an obligation to pay in advance, after having paid in advance, you do not get the goods, then the state suffers loss. Okay? So it means, therefore, that in making the assessment and the determination that you are accepting an obligation to pay in advance, you possibly did not take certain things into account that enables you to prevent such losses. Now, if you read all of these sections, while there is scope in terms of the treasury regulation that you may pay in advance if the agreement says so, there is another provision that says you must prevent fruitless and wasteful expenditure and irregular expenditure and prevent the losses. But here it makes specific reference to criminal conduct. But I think the spirit of the legislation, when you read in totality, is that, and read with the paragraph B of this subsection, which talks about efficient economic and effective use of resources. When there are losses being incurred, therefore, there isn't effective and efficient use of resources. So when you look at it in totality, while you do have scope, you must be absolutely certain that the entity you're making an advance payment to is in fact going to deliver on the obligation that it's supposed to deliver on. So that is the understanding that accounting officers ought to have. And that is the understanding that the committee ought to have in relation to what this provision what this part of the legislation says. I will pause there, Chair, and if there's any clarification questions, then I can address them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nangalo. I think let me give the opportunity to the members to interact with this part. Honorable Stain, Honorable Omen, Honorable Tolle,
Honorable Bula and Honorable Njobe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I thought there wasn't going to be questions, so I was going to say it looks like the committee understands this. My question, though, is does our accounting officers, and I'm talking about across the spectrum in public service, do they actually understand that? Because the sorts of things that you were talking about that they should be looking out for happens more often than not. And one of the problems that I've got with this PFMA, although it makes provision for certain sanctions, they are actually never applied. So, you know, almost tongue-in-cheek want to suggest that this sort of presentation should be given to all the accounting officers to make them aware of exactly what their responsibilities are. Thank you.
Yes, Chairperson, I think I'm covered, except to say that I found it initially quite confusing. But I think with the explanation given here this morning in that one makes that advance payment with the understanding responsibly. And I think that has certainly clarified it for me. But I think, no, I think the important question is, in ensuring that the accounting officers know how to interpret all these bits of legislation.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm confused. I must say so, because if you are talking about the advance payment, but at the same time when he says there's some risk. So if the service provider failed to deliver, what happens?
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, Chair, it is all about having your cake and eating it at the same time. you know, quite often, Chair, that we are informed through media, it might not be correct. You normally hear National Treasury, National Departments, owing. So outstanding on this issue, outstanding on that. Now, it comes to light adequately when you talk about prepayments and outstanding and risk management. It comes to light. But I want to very, very strongly also associate myself with the comments mentioned by Honorable Stein, that whilst we want to ensure that the smooth flow, or rather shall we say the sound financial management, infiltrates in all spheres of government. I want to make an example. Chairperson, you know, there was a contractor in KwaZulu-Natal that had been paid out a huge amount of money, over about 200 million, I think. And there was a conflict between the province and the Tigweni municipality as to who instructed the payment and how they were going to recoup the money, and they were waiting for National Treasury. Now, if you find yourself in such a predicament, how would you apply your sound rules of Section 7 to ensure that this is not repeated and the good sound management of accountancy will infiltrate in these areas as well to prevent such mismanagement again? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I'm partly covered by the Honourable question, because I want to find out whether there's any provision maybe in the regulations of the Treasury as to what happens to an accounting officer who puts the state in a position where losses are incurred. Whether it is a small sum of money or big sum of money, but what really happens to the accounting officer who has not taken enough precaution to ensure that, you know, the state does not lose. As for the prepayment, we all know it happens everywhere. We all have examples that we can quote of service providers who have been paid even before they have done the job. Particularly, I must say, the prisons disadvantage contractors because they don't have, perhaps they don't have the funds to carry out the task unless they are provided some funds by the government. But in the end, you find that the state, the government loses because the contractor does not complete the task. It happens also in the human settlements area. But one is not going to go into that. I just want to find out, what do you do with the accounting officers who keep on making the state lose?
Okay, thank you. So.
Chairperson, this is a these are tough questions, some of them. particularly Mama Njobe's question around SMMEs and creating an enabling environment for them to thrive and provide an opportunity for job creation. But I'll come back to that. It's a difficult balancing act that one has to do there. But let me just go with the questions from top to down. Do the accounting officers know this? Honorable Stein, if they don't know, the problem is that there is Chapter 10 of the PFMA, which makes it a criminal offense if you are not willfully or negligently are unable to carry out your responsibilities in terms of this legislation. So if an accounting officer doesn't know, I think it is the accounting officer's, it is to the accounting officer's advantage if the accounting officer seeks assistance in understanding these matters. I think what comes out, we will possibly explore an opportunity where we could talk in various forums where the accounting officers are available on these matters, and hopefully accounting officers will be available. We've done this in the provinces, in some of the provinces. It's easier when it's on invitation than when you're pushing it to people. When people ask for it, it works easier because then you can engage properly. So I can't say they do. From what I've experienced, some don't. Some actually do understand the legislation quite well. All I can say is there are dangers. If you're an accounting officer and you don't know, you could end up in jail for 5 years. So it is in your interest to know. Sanctions never applied. May I just skip on that? But I think it's a broader question, and somebody asked about it as well, around what happens when people don't comply. It's a broader question. I think we will see action being taken on the PFMA if you honorable members are vigilant about your own legislation. The pieces of legislation we're dealing with are pieces of legislation passed by this government, passed by this parliament. And therefore, this parliament has to make sure that when this legislation is not being followed, parliament takes that seriously. So I will start there, because if everything else fails, if the executive authorities don't enforce, if the accounting officers don't enforce where the accounting officers have got to enforce, the population of this country relies on parliament to take its interest to heart. And the piece of legislation that have been put in place are put in place with that in mind. So, yes, I think there hasn't been sanctions in terms of the PFMA in most instances. Where you find the Public Service Commission report, which does report on some of the disciplinary hearings that take place, if you look at that report, the majority of the people that are affected by disciplinary hearing are from level 12 downwards. So in other words, below senior management service in the public sector, which could be construed to say that the law is biased towards the lower levels of society. And that's not quite a good thing to have. So there is some action, but that action tends to affect people that perhaps could be construed to be vulnerable. In recent past,
there have been accounting officers leaving their jobs. There has been chief executive officers of entities being asked to leave their jobs as a result of the implementation of the provisions in the PFMA. Limited as it may be, I think we're seeing the emergence of that happening. So there are sanctions that are coming up. Sanctions are there. It's the willingness to carry them out that is an issue. Now, you say you're confused. What happens then if the service provider does not fulfill the obligation? Let me first say that if the service provider doesn't provide the application, then the account officer is in trouble. That's the first thing to say. Because his assessment, with the best of knowledge of information that he had at the time, may have not picked up certain things that are resulting in that eventuality when the service provider is not able to deliver. So then the account officer finds himself in a difficult situation, unless he can take remedial actions quickly that ensure that the state doesn't lose. Then the accounting officer bears the responsibility. The philosophy of the PFMA moves away from the old dispensation where everything you had a role for. When I joined government, if you are at a certain level, you are entitled to a certain type of a desk, certain type of furniture and carpet in your office if you are a senior. So you don't want those types of rules. You want managers to manage and decide how they spend the resources at their disposal, but they must be held accountable for the decisions they take. So accounting officer may be in trouble, and somebody may have to hold the accounting officer accountable. But what does the accounting officer recourse does the accounting officer has against the service provider? The contract, I would presume, would have made sufficient provisions. If you enter into a contract that allows you to make prepayments, you should then make provisions in that contract that allows for this eventuality to be managed should it arise. If that is not the case, then the accounting officer did not enter into that agreement responsibly. He remains responsible for that outcome. So that's the unfortunate part. You can enter into the agreement, but when you enter into that agreement, you also take the responsibility for the downside when it materializes. Our cake and eat it. How do we prevent this from happening again? There's a few things. One is the one that I've just made reference to. If the accounting officers are held accountable for their decisions, somebody at least asks the accounting officer to answer questions. And if found to have been guilty, that's appropriately charged. Depending on the severity of the matter, the charge may well be a charge that takes somebody to jail. If the matter is not that severe, the charge may be just a mere disciplinary process and a warning. But that will make sure that people begin to do this. But you would rather have a preventative mechanism. In our interactions, we have chief financial officers' forums. We do address these questions when they arise. So departments do raise questions that they've got problems with in relation to the PFMA, issues that they've got problems with in relation to the challenges they have in implementing the legislation. I have two questions that I have to answer this afternoon that come from the provinces. So we have those interactions to make sure that there's widespread knowledge and understanding of the legislation and its implications. And hopefully that will prevent these from happening. But when they happen, then I think the consequences should follow. Honorable Manjove, there's a serious challenge with the issue you're raising, and it's an important issue because our priorities are about job creation, about ensuring that we grow the economy. And we all understand that to grow the economy, small and medium enterprises play an important role in employing people, but also in driving some of the growth in the economy. So government ought to act in a manner that enables that to happen. But that doesn't mean government should act irresponsibly. Now, I've quoted the sections here, the one dealing with issues of working capital. Now, there's many ways in which you manage that scenario. And one of those ways is that if you are dealing with a small service provider, already the legislation says you must pay within 30 days of receiving of invoice. So once the service provider has delivered, you can actually pay the service provider immediately after delivering the service, so that the service provider doesn't have to wait. When I worked in the private sector and we were engaging in small medium enterprise development as a company, we were selling cement in the industry that I was working on. We came up with a mechanism that we called load on load. So the small business would come in, buy a load of cement, well, we had a credit arrangement, buy a load of cement, and they pay for it. And then they can take another one. Until we can see the pattern that they are able to pay and so on, and then graduate them into a full credit mechanism. There's no reason why we can't come with creative mechanisms that allow small enterprises to be able to continue to operate while managing the risk that we have to manage. Yes, it calls on us to think differently about the way we do things, but there's no reason why we can't come with creative ways to support small enterprises while not exposing government to unnecessary risk. The two things are not mutually exclusive. They can be done. So what needs to happen in that instance is that as government officials, we need to be sensitive to government policy to start with. We are all here to implement government policy. So we need to be sensitive to government policy. And our sensitivity to government policy then calls upon us to devise mechanisms that allow government policy to be implemented within the law. So it's that balance that we have to strike. What specific things can be put in place? We can have all manner of suggestions that can come to mind in relation to how that can be managed. But it can be done. Thank you, Chair.
Well, I think it's clear. I don't think we need more explanation on this one. But I think we also raised the issue of the service provider. And I think you can just your observations in terms of the spending pattern on this one. Just the summary. Don't want the details. In your observations as the National Treasurer, whilst you were evaluating the departmental report. Thank you.
I mean, as you all know, that the rural household infrastructure grant is the grant that you're talking about around the payments and the prepayments to the IDT. I mean, this is a Schedule 7 grant, which is an allocation in kind to municipalities in this case to provide on-site water and sanitation solutions. So what the department has done is they've gone up and open tender and appointed Mvula Trust and the IDT as service providers. So the 100 million rand was appropriated, and because it is a new program and a new function in the department, I mean, they've really struggled in getting the program off the ground, and we only started seeing expenditure on the grant in the third quarter of the financial year. When the department had amended the contract with the IDT in February 2011, expenditure on this grant was 11%. The department subsequently spent 52 million rand in March, which then took expenditure up to 63% at the end of the financial year. Not all of the 52 million rand that the department had spent related to the prepayment. It was only 14 million rand that was the prepayment, but I mean 14% expenditure on a conditional grant in the last month of the financial year. Well, you know, the department isn't unique in the situation that we see the IDT in. And the department's not unique to all of that, because there's a trend, about 18 national and provincial departments who have transferred significant amounts of money to the IDT in the last month of the financial year. So the IDT got between those 18 departments about 2.6 billion rand a year. 25 in last financial year, 22.6 billion rand was paid over to the IDT for various projects across 18 national and provincial departments. This ranges from public works, education, provincial roads, provincial health departments. And 25% of all the money that the IDT received from provincial national departments in the year was received in March. So there's a general trend from national and provincial departments to transfer money quite late to the IDT. I don't know if it shows that we're improving expenditure performance, but and we don't all know the conditions in which the money was transferred. We know about the money in the national department, but it's a significant amount, and there does seem to be this general growing change to transfer large amounts of money to the IDT in late in the financial year.
Chair, one general point that can be made in relation to this without the specific matter, and I'm hoping accounting officers would have thought sensibly about what they normally do, is that there was a year in which March tends to be the what we have come to call the dumping month. And we call it the dumping month because we don't know any better. But there doesn't seem to be sensible conclusion you can come to other than that, where departments find a mechanism of getting the money out. And strangely, IDT tends to be the recipient of these monies. There's one year in which about 6 billion rand actually flew in March, and all of it went to IDT. The problem with that, from an oversight perspective, when you look at the numbers of the department, you see that expenditure has gone through. And let's just take a simple example. We're building schools. And if 80% of the money relating to building of schools goes to IDT at the end of the year, you get a picture from the numbers that tells you all of the money for building schools has been spent. Right? But there are no schools. Because money only got transferred in March. And the question that comes to mind, if I was sitting on the side of oversight, I would say, who's fooling who?
Mm.
Because I think we have an obligation to society to deliver services, and therefore we'd rather reflect a picture that shows that services have been delivered rather than an artificial picture. So there is that issue, there is that dilemma that all oversight structures, all committees must always be sensitive to. And demand explanation. I'm not prejudging that there would be no logical explanation from accounting officers, but I would love to be sitting on the bench and listening when accounting officers are explaining why would you transfer 6 billion rand right at the end of the year. What I'm saying is, as oversight, you need to raise the question, then accounting officers need to answer. Maybe there is a sensible reason. I don't know.
I would suggest that let's not take this matter further. DJ, I'm not going to give you the opportunity because this is not the time for the committee to interact with the department. Otherwise, I think the portfolio committee was so kind to allow the department to be part of this just to listen, because we are still going to engage. We do have our platform. This was an information session for the committee. We should have just said, let's have this session with the National Treasurer alone. Because when we engage the department, I think the National Treasurer is willing to be part, so that, as you have said, you would love to be there when we are engaging with the accounting officers as the public representative, and then you will listen to their response. This is not the opportunity for that, because we have got a tight schedule. We're still going to have a meeting which is unscheduled.
I accept that. I thought, as the only accounting officer in the house, you may have appreciated to hear a view from an accounting officer perspective, not to deal with the detail on the matter, because the matter was more about accounting officers, but I accept your guidance on the matter.
I don't want to open it wider than this one. Let's leave it in this way, because the information we wanted, we have received. But I think I have to also explain to the National Treasurer that in with regards to our letter, we raised an issue, but that issue we are dealing with internally. So we're not going to raise it here. We're dealing with it internally. Thank you. Mr. Steyn and Mr. Bula.
I must make use of this opportunity, because it's not often that we can teach Treasury something. What I want to say is that as the Department of Human Settlements, I think to some extent they have been thinking out of the box in terms of the question raised by my honourable colleague about particularly SMMEs and so on. There are agencies within the department that do provide bridging finance, that would take a higher risk than obviously the department should take. So yes, there are probably still some gaps, but there are bridging finance for those that don't have the finance to basically get them off the ground.
No, thank you, Chair. It's definitely going to be a simple question. But I've taken note of the fact that members must be vigilant, because this is their piece of legislation. But then there's a slight contradiction. On one hand, that members must be vigilant, but on the other hand, accounting officers must be held accountable for the decisions that they take. So then you've got this both gaps, and what is the jurisdiction, the limitations of our vigilancy in view of accounting officers?
Mr. Bula, you are out of
order. Okay, all right, thank you.
You have to know your obligations, why you are here as a member of parliament. But what I would say to the National Treasury, we thank you very much, because we have to make sure that in any in any manner we are dealing with our oversight, we must be sure that we are on the right track. We must not make mistakes. And I think oversight is about, it's not to come after there is a damage that has been already made. You have to be proactive as the people who are doing oversight. But when the circumstances come, you have to be able to tackle them in the right way. So we really appreciate your willingness as the National Treasurer. In fact, it's your obligation to do that. It's not even your willingness. You are obliged to ensure that you build capacity to all of us as public representatives. You are empowering us now during this session. So I think this session was very valuable for us, and it was very much worthwhile. We thank you very much. This is not the first time we interact with National Treasurer, and we'll keep on interacting, because we are in a field. So when you are in a field, there's quite a lot of issues that come up, so that needed or that will need to be attended to. So we'll keep on knocking at the treasury doors. Thank you very much. I think we can release you.
Thank you.
Thanks. We are welcoming us, Honorable Mabel. Oh, Mabel. Let's take a comfort break for 5 minutes, and then we come back and deal with the departmental presentations. Thank you. Which one, the TG, are you going to start with? or the cooperative housing. Okay. Okay, let's I welcome you back. We will give this opportunity to the DG. And there is a presentation members you have in your possession that deals with the DFI. That one, we are not going to deal with it today. The DG has requested that we give him an opportunity to finalize the matter with the minister. So, because it has to be approved by the minister, it has not yet been approved. So, let's shelve it for another day. So, on your behalf, I just responded to the DG to say the request is accepted. So, DG, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members, we will present to you as per the last engagement that we have had on this matter, particularly in relation to the policy issues that the members have put emphasis in our last presentation regarding progress to date. And I would like to do this presentation, Chair, with your permission, in two parts. And I would appreciate that maybe the comments and question session should take place thereafter, because some of the questions may relate to the second part. The second part of the presentation, Chair, will be mainly focusing on the implementation strategy in relation to the housing co-ops policy, which we think if we don't do it in that fashion, there might be questions on the first presentation that might be linked to the second one. So it's one presentation into two parts by different presenters. Having said that, Chair, I will then ask Louis van der Walt to do the presentation, and he will be assisted by Mr. Diet, and then the second presentation will follow thereafter. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Honorable members, apologies, there's a very weak link between the computer and the cable, yeah, because the cable is not a makeshift cable. The original cable was apparently stolen this morning. This is a replacement reserve cable. The purpose of this presentation, Madam, the first part of it, as the DG indicated, is just to show you that the work that we've done in terms of progress in the development of cooperative housing sector. I'll try to keep my finger on this case now. Okay. Just to recap, and to refresh our memories, the term cooperative is used to describe a group of people who collaborate voluntarily to meet common economic, social, and cultural needs through a joint-owned and democratically controlled enterprise. Housing cooperative, on the other side, as a dimension of cooperatives, then, legally registered entity or association comprising people who collectively own land and govern their housing needs on a not-for-profit basis. Section 4 of the Cooperatives Act 2005 gives recognition to housing cooperatives. So the legislation already provides for the establishment of cooperatives, and it also regulates how they operate. Why should you go for a cooperative environment or arrangement? And it's actually obvious, but let's recap on it. By working together, members of the cooperative can provide themselves with better and more affordable housing than they can and that they could do and achieve as individuals. Within the housing sector, a cooperative housing needs the particular needs of the people wishing to build the community have a say in how the housing is managed and promote the culture of democracy. A housing cooperative differs from other forms of tenure in that the residents share responsibility, ownership, governance of the house. So you, in the cooperative housing cooperative, you will occupy your unit on the basis that you are a member of this cooperative. Let's just recap on the current enabling environment that we've established to date. I have alluded to the Cooperatives Act 2005. Let me go back. This act was designed to assist cooperatives to flourish throughout South Africa. The definition of cooperatives in the Act provides for the following. Housing cooperatives means a primary cooperative that provides housing to its members, or a secondary cooperative that provides technical sectoral services to a primary housing cooperative. Let's leave it. Section 4, one of the acts specifically includes housing cooperatives as a form of a cooperative covered by the provisions of the Act. The Act furthermore regulates the registration of cooperatives and operational procedures that they must abide by. Then we have created the Social Housing Regulating Authority, or SHRA, as everybody refers to it, which champions the cause of housing cooperatives and other housing institutions, of course, by building capacity in the cooperative sector and regulates the accreditation process. You would see in the second part of the presentation the current progress and planning that has been put in place by the SHRA to specifically focus on housing cooperatives now. Then, obviously, you know about the African Housing Cooperatives Association, which is an apex body which unites, represents, and provides leadership to the housing cooperative throughout South Africa. The Department of Trade and Industry has developed a strategy to assist cooperatives. I think it was presented to you some time ago. And the main was the objective was of reducing the regulatory burden to empower cooperatives and to enhance the autonomy of cooperatives. The strategy envisages non-financial support and also financial support, creating a demand for the products of cooperatives, and improving the sustainability of the cooperative institutions themselves. Since the cooperative focus has dawned on us, we have developed from the department draft guidelines on the national housing programs, what exists, what the focus of the programs are, and how to access it and to contact. This document is now in the process of being finalized, and we will publish it and make it known, available to everybody as soon as we finalize it and obtain the DG's approval. Very briefly, just an oversight, what we discuss in the document is to say that housing assistance is provided through housing cooperatives in respect of their members who qualify for housing subsidies, obviously, mainly through the social housing program. This program provides capital grants to institutions for the development of non-individual ownership housing options. The program will require all cooperatives, if they want to access the funding, to be accredited by the SHRA. Once accredited with the SHRA, Madam Chair, the cooperative may also be assisted with training and startup facilitation funding available under the social housing program, which is quite substantial. And you will see that we've introduced a program in terms of which we're quite serious to create sustainable institutions for the future. Social housing subsidy is calculated on a percentage of the development cost of the dwellings and varies from project to project, depending on the nature of the design of the buildings and so forth. In a multi-story building, you will see in the next presentation the amounts are set out for you. What you can accumulate is quite substantial, what government invests in this regard. The social housing program only applies to restructuring zones, unfortunately, because it's orientated towards the redevelopment of specific areas. And if your cooperative is then active in that area, it will qualify as an institution, an accredited institution, to also participate. Where cooperatives are then operational outside of restructuring zones, they will have to access the institutional housing subsidy program. The subsidy is substantially lower because it's single individual level unit that is normally targeted by that program. And as you can see, the subsidy currently amounts to 52,427. This amount is then also annually adjusted in terms of the delegated authority assigned to the DG. Any residual amount required to facilitate a complete unit must come from the resources of the institution, the cooperative, and they will mainly then apply to an HFC for credit in this regard. Cooperatives may furthermore elect to involve their members in the construction of their own houses, so in that regard, the People's Housing Process Program has been designed to accept the role of the cooperative itself as the facilitating or implementing agent, then leading the project, justified as the applicant or the implementing agent, and can then apply as the technical assistant financial support organization to assist their members to build their own houses. Cooperatives wishing to apply for grant funding and capacity building assistance available through the National Housing Programs are advised to contact the Social Housing Regulating Authority through the Department of Human Settlements. In the guidelines, we would like to provide the contact details of the SRA, where you can contact them and how, what process to be followed. It should be noted that all project applications considered obviously must eventually be approved by the MEC. What we've done is we've added to the guidelines a list of all the HOD departments Human Settlements and Housing all over the country so that you can have access to the contact details. Funding for approved short projects is also administered by the MECs, and it's important that proper planning is done in collaboration with the MECs. We have to ensure that your priority project is aligned with the priority funding reservations annually made by the MEC. Critical success factors. I think we should recognize cooperatives in all sectors, not only in the policy but in the implementing side as well, that they have a role to play and they can make a valuable contribution towards relieving the housing shortages, especially for their members there. The policy is already in place to facilitate grant funding, and the capital grant funding is in place. We must just make it work there. The cooperative legislation has been designed to facilitate a streamlined process. Is in place already to regulate these, to ensure that our investments are safe. What we need to do is to, through the regulating agency, make sure that they are sustainable and abide by the rules and can flourish in the environment. Public and or private finance institutions need to be prepared to receive pre-occupancy savings of cooperative housing members and provide short-term construction and long-term financing for cooperative housing projects. In terms of housing programs for non-ownership individual and group housing, there's always a requirement that the institution must contribute a certain level of capital towards the program, the project cost. And these must come from the private sector. The cooperative housing technical service organizations, we should enhance them and make sure that they play their role. They refer to as DSOs. They provide a range of services to the individuals wanting to resolve their housing problem with the cooperative ownership vehicle. And they can offer, for example, assistance on selection of land, project design, supervision of construction, education and training to its members, the board of directors and the committee members on their respective responsibilities. They can secure short-term and long-term project financing for them and project operations and management, of course. So they play an important role. In terms of the way forward, as I've indicated, we would like to finalize the draft guideline document, get obtain the approval of the DG and publish it on our website and also make it available to the sector. And we will finalize the institutional arrangements specifically that support the housing institution in collaboration with the FRA so that we have an aligned and a coherent guideline document. Next time we'll ask, bear with me so that I can transfer quickly.
Thank you very much. Can you ask us what is CSO? Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair. What I'm going to present now is to just continue from where my colleague has left. To say on the institutional arrangements, to say that there will be institutional arrangements between the SHRA and the cooperative. Mr. Masipi was invited in this meeting. This is not because I've been looking at the door, but I don't know. To do that, maybe talk on what we've done together so far. This is the presentation of the implementation side of things. The Social Housing Act in terms of the housing cooperative. To present, I've divided it into six sections. To the purpose of the presentation, what does the Social Housing Act say, role of cooperatives, plan of action, which is, I think, the more important for this meeting, and the way forward. The purpose is to update the portfolio committee on the department support towards implementation of the sustainable cooperative model. That is in terms of the Social Housing Act and the broader national department program.
Chairperson and members of the committee, we've noted that in terms of implementation, the cooperative's role is very important in terms of both providing for sustainable human settlements, but also we need to consider the fact that these are the institutions that need to be empowered or capacitated in terms of providing for their economic needs, in terms of job creation and in terms of even delivering on the housing, but also they should be taken as major contributors to the economic sector in terms of developing. What that means is that a model that has been identified and is being implemented is considering their role in not only in developing the houses, but their role in management of those, and further to that, their role in social housing and the reserves that they can generate so that they can be able to build for their members again. And this is the Social Housing Act. I think Louis has talked to this one. I will skip this slide because I'm going to talk on the definitions. What we've done is to just zoom on the role of cooperatives themselves. We are regarding them as the valid delivery agent for social housing, as has been said in the policy. They must subscribe to the same regulations as that of the social housing institutions. That is in the Social Housing Act. They must be accredited. I will talk to the accreditation process, as it is important for implementation. They must acquire, develop, and manage social housing stock, which I've just talked to. There are three roles that they must do in terms of this program. They must fulfill all reporting requirements, which is also in terms of the regulations, and they must be subject to the regulations like it is said in the Social Housing Act. They must reinvest operational surpluses into new social housing projects, which is very important. And we're saying as a department, we need to be able to have a model that talks to them being able to do that, and that requires capacity and investment. What we've done, the SHRA, as the implementing agent of the department, is implementing or capacitating the social housing model. And in so doing, that is also looking at the cooperatives. What's important there, firstly, we look at the cooperative services that they provide. They need, the SHRA is in a position to provide for the outreach programs, that is the communication plans and awareness, because we find that it was very important that the cooperatives must be aware of the programs and be aware of what they need to be doing as cooperatives. There should be agreements that are in place for delivery, and they have not been left out in outcomes aid. They should be able to provide sector reports and financial statements. But what is more important right now as in terms of implementation, what was important is that they should be accredited. And Mr. Van der Walt did refer to this accreditation process, which has started. What the cooperatives need to do is to apply for accreditation. I will talk to the process of accreditation more, and then they will be issued with accreditation certificates, and they will be registered on the accreditation register as the other institution. And then they will have access to the funding that is provided for them by the Act and the regulation. But what is more important, we did realize that In terms of investment, we need to have a specific development cooperative strategy, engagement strategy. That means all those units that we've developed, we've allocated for them, we need to engage them further on their roles and what is there, and we really need to put the government's issues together. Engagements up to now, there was a meeting between SACA and the SHRA on the 9th of June. What was more important was that having experienced challenges with the traditional way of implementing the cooperative model, the English, if I may say, European traditional model is not working in South Africa. We need a model that was presented by SACA. And they advise us that we need to perhaps consider housing cooperatives, the secondary cooperatives that are provincially based,
he gave an example of saying we need to consider something like Gauteng Housing Secondary Cooperative, your Eastern Cape Secondary Housing Cooperative. That will be the primary cooperative for the small cooperatives in that province. This entity will own the property and provide support to primary cooperatives who will develop and manage the stock. And this will be used as a pilot. And that's what they provided to us and presented. It is proposed that the SRA and the SACA will sign an agreement that sets out the parameters of partnership. And this Gauteng Housing Secondary Cooperative will submit its business plan to the SRA for consideration. They have also applied for the establishment of the grant to set up the organization. So the support, the pilot and the engagement ended there, that this is what should we do, and we should just pilot that. But this is a principle that has been put forward. Okay, I will not talk about number four on the slide, because this talks to the Turkey convention that they need to be going to, so that we understand the cooperative. A brief overview of the model. I spoke to this Gauteng pilot, which will be the Gauteng pilot as a secondary and the primary developer. The primary organization attached to the secondary cooperative. There will be two roles for it. One, it should be a developer, and two, it should be a property manager, the primary cooperative. But then it will be advised and also be a reporting to the secondary cooperative. And what is needed as a way forward is to draft and conclude an agreement between the SRA and SACA to give consideration to the request for establishment of the grant for the Gauteng Housing Social Cooperative, give consideration to the business plan and proposed projects, collaborate with the Gauteng Department of Local Government in this human settlement to establish this, develop the growth and establishment plan. And we further indicated that there is a working model that we need to really develop for the country. I will talk on the implementation in terms of accreditation. This process involves the application for accreditation, as I indicated. What is done by the SRA is that when the institution applies for accreditation, it can be declined, it can be approved. When declined, it is not declined and they say, no, we decline you and we're not going to do anything. If they decline, they will advise to say, you need to do A, B, and C, and we will be a resource to you to get to accreditation. So the housing cooperative need to be involved in that process as well. And if they are accredited, they then are allowed to apply for the recession capital grant. And if they are not accredited, they need to fix what they have to do and be in contact with the SRA and the resource person of the SRA that will be able to capacitate them and make them accredited. There is a capacity building program for the cooperatives in the SRA, so they need to be engaged in that program until such time that the SRA does make sure that they can be successful for accreditation and then qualify for the research and capital grant. This is the definition that maybe what was important there was that we felt that the cooperatives maybe don't really understand what is meant by the Social Housing Act in terms of their role, or even in terms of the definition. That's why there you see numbers that we are talking about the rental, and we're talking about low income, we're talking about institutionalized, we're talking about a social housing program, we're talking about it as a delivery agent, we're talking about it and that the fact that the projects must be approved and they must be in the restructuring zones. And they can access public funds. This is what I was trying to define. the roles. When I started presenting, I said for the department and the SHRA, it was important that we capacitate the institutions to deliver more housing. Also, we need to take into account that they have to be sustainable and be able to be economically stable. Then, in terms of the Social Housing Act, then they have three roles to fulfill. That one of the owner, the developer, and the property manager. And all these roles, if they're a property manager, the rentals are going to them. If they're a developer, they will access the funding, the restructuring capital grant, and then at the end of the day, they will be able to be owners after maybe 15 years, which is in terms of the Social Housing Act. The funding that Louis referred to is has been on that slide. This was also in the information sharing session with them called FoodSucker to say that this is what they have access to. The research and capital grant in terms of the projects, and this is from the department, the national department, and the provincial top-up, which provides for the variant component, and this is from the provincial capital grant, and then there are these capacitation grants that I spoke about that starts with the project acquisition and feasibility, pre-accreditation and gear up, general capacity building. These three, all the cooperatives qualify, both primary and secondary, they qualify to get these grants. And we were talking about also advising them about other ways of financing this. From the cooperatives, their contribution, we're expecting that they might contribute in terms of their maybe savings, if they do, or equity. In terms of equity, it's we're looking at land. Maybe there are cooperatives that have land that they can contribute into that. The right side of the slide is just to advise. It was advising them on what they could do and the importance of maybe engaging NHFC in terms of loans. This is also the on the funding aspect that the government, it's simply what is being said here is that the government subsidizes 60% of all the projects that are being done in terms of social housing and are being done by cooperatives. Then what they have to do is to just abide by the regulations, and the support is there. This is one slide that was just talking to them that what is it that they need to submit, what is it that they in terms of the Social Housing Act, they must do. And also on that one, that the exit, that if you want to be they want to not to be involved in the program anymore and they've been involved, they cannot sell the stock, and we are not expecting them to sell the stock because we know that some of the people that are there are their members. They cannot sell the stock until it's after 15 years. If they do sell the stock for 15 years, before 15 years, there'll be a penalty. And that sale must be cleared with the SHRA. And the conditions of sale will remain catering for rental. What will happen is that if the secondary institution is liquidated and they cannot operate anymore, they need to be selling it to another institution that is also a cooperative that will use it for rental. That is just that what was important for them, it did indicate that it's important that they need meaningful involvement and participation of their members in this. But we refer to them as tenants. The reason being that also in this model, they are allowed to tenant. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, DJ. I think I must commend the DJ for the work that has been done. At least from the previous meetings that we held, there is an improvement, but I'm not saying
we are satisfied with the improvement, but let's comment there is an improvement. But I think I must justify what I'm raising here. We still have to sit, because this word cooperative is contested. We can develop our own model. It is right to develop a model that is going to be suitable for our country, as South Africans. But why I'm raising this, we have had meetings with social housing, several meetings, and they denied totally that they deal with cooperatives. And they pointed out clearly that social housing is not rental. I mean, cooperatives is not rental. Social housing is directly rental. So we don't know what's in Romania. Where are you pushing this agenda of the cooperative to be specifically rental? I don't have a problem about the legislation. If we have made a mess on the legislation, let's look at the legislation itself. Because I think I'm one of the people who was part of the processing and passing of that legislation. I don't remember most of the issues there, but I can remember that there is one sentence that talks about cooperatives, or one clause, or one section, but one section. But I think we have to revisit the legislation itself, but not in this platform. We need a different platform. We engage with each other, and then we convince each other. Honorable members, Honorable Bowman, Honorable Steyn, Honorable Bula, thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I was actually going to introduce my points by saying I'm really going to ask stupid questions today, because I want clarity, and partly based on what the Chairperson has just said, but perhaps let's go back a little bit. I think the first bit of clarity I would like to understand is these restructuring zones that you talk about. And you talk about predetermined restructuring zones. Do we know already where those are those still to be established? Are there certain criteria that will establish those? If I could just have clarity on what those are. Then I get on to a point where I'm actually beginning to feel a bit confused, and that is when I hear of talking about own building and developers and the rental stock. This all comes into this part now that I'm not understanding very well, and I think it's because I'm ignorant. Because in a cooperative, my perhaps original understanding was that it's a group of people that get together and they're going to construct their homes, and you know, they get financed and do. Now I see we're going developers and all sorts of other things. So I'm not understanding. And perhaps what I would ask is that, quite aside from the presentation, if you just say 10 people form a cooperative and they now want to build their houses. Just take us through a simple thing like that gives us the flow of how it will work. And then I think just a last question, Chairperson, when we come to this thing about selling the houses after 15 years and so on, that's another part that I'm a bit confused about. Because I can't imagine if you've built into something that you now are going to want to sell it. But how, in view of the fact that we've had all the trouble with our RDP houses and not being able to control it or monitor it, how does this get, I know you're saying it's SHRA's responsibility, but how is that going to be properly monitored?
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I think I want to latch on to what both you and the Honourable Bowman said. There's a lot of parallels in the presentation being drawn between cooperatives and social housing. And I think up to now, some of us have really been thinking that there may be parallels, but it was two separate processes. And it's almost like you're bringing it together into one in this presentation. And I think that's where the confusion is coming about. Because whilst you're doing that, you also, for example, and unfortunately this slide doesn't have numbers, but there's a particular slide where you make specific reference to the PHPs, which we know, whilst it may be done via a cooperative, it's not social housing and it becomes the beneficiaries retain ownership. And that touches on the confusion but having said that, I'm just wondering if I go along for the moment that it's almost one and the same with slight differences. The questions that I've got is, for example, you talk about another regulatory body for cooperatives. Now, I mean, very specifically, if you're going to almost throw it into the same pot with small differences, why would we need to establish another regulatory body? Would the SHRA not be the obvious body to regulate cooperatives as well? Then, Chair, you know that it's been a bugbear of yourself, and in fact, Honourable Richard, the whole cooperative thing. And you've indicated that you've been busy with the guidelines for some time. I'm just wondering why it's taking so long. The Cooperative Act was established in 2005. You're talking about draft guidelines that must still go out for comment and so on. I mean, we're talking about 6 years, really. And it's the sort of thing that we do know that very many disadvantaged people are actually very good at cooperatives. They form all sorts of cooperatives. And yet, to some extent, I think with us dragging our feet in this regard, we're depriving them of accessing this type of thing, which would obviously assist us in the delivery of housing. Then, I'm a little bit concerned about this, and I'd like to get more information, Chairperson, not necessarily today, about this pilot project and this unit that's now going to be established in Gauteng and exactly how it's going to work, because it sounds to me almost like they will end up being the regulator, although they must also seek accreditation. But I'm not, with the information at hand here today, I'm not sure if that is the right way to go as a pilot project for the rest of the country. And then just lastly, Chairperson, just a bit of a query that came up during the presentation. When we spoke about the funding, and I must just see that maybe in the first, no, I think it was in this, when we spoke about, or the presenter spoke about the funding, he specifically mentioned savings, that some cooperatives may have some savings that they want to contribute. And yet, we then get to the point where it actually doesn't become, and forget about the 15 years for now, but initially it doesn't become the ownership of each individual family. It's co-ownership. So, you know, I'm going to be very reluctant to put in my savings if the end product is not going to belong to me. So it's almost like there's a contradiction there. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the topic has been exhausted adequately, but just a few comments. I think that the DG has done a phenomenal job. If you look at the various models of housing, and in this instance we're referring to the PHP, we're referring to the social housing. But Chairperson, if you look at the approach of cooperatives, and this is precisely why Japan and Germany has become world economic powers, because of the SMME and the informal sector. And I think we must laud you for this kind of approach, trying to formalize this. Obviously, we had challenges in the past, and I don't want to be critical. But I think you have summed all of these challenging areas to come to deliver a friendly model that can deliver good homes for our people, and we must commend the department for that. You know, Chair, The entire presentation today reminds me of our trip to Australia and the highly commercialized manner in which government comes in as partnership, wanting to give a certain project in terms of the strategic and business plan funding in order to deliver these houses. And this kind of approach is reminding me of that. But I think all of that will synchronize after the document that the DG is referring to has been finalized, so we can get our feet down into the mud and start delivering. But Honorable Bowman made a concern around the issue about rental housing stock, and I think one of the aspects that has been omitted was the also currently we are establishing, experiencing these problems of the enhanced extended discount benefit scheme. I see there is a touch of what appears on that subsidy in terms of the social housing stock. How is that both going to link, one? And then also, I don't want to put the cart before the horse, because your document still has to go out for comment. And it might be a separate new entity or model, but I see you have precisely omitted the role of the NHBRC, the HDA. So I don't want to elaborate on that until we have scrutinized the document and come about with all of that. But on the whole, Chair, I want to say that I agree with the DG when he said that I want to do two separate presentations. Evaluating the facts that have been presented here today, I would take it further. The first presentation also is imperative to ensure that the model of funding and the particular competence and skills are received by the cooperatives, and that must be binding in order for us to ultimately ensure that these cooperatives are going to deliver in terms of your document, and how are you going to achieve those goals. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think you might have realized today that I had a lot of hiccups when I was presenting. For some reason is that, honestly, the pilot, let me start with the pilot, that we are really looking at. This was the presentation and the idea of SACA after the communication that we need to really pilot this. Not that we are not aware of the fact that there are other areas and we need to do some more work on the cooperatives. And this leads us to the developer, manager, and the other roles. My presentation, Chair, was based on the rental section or rental implementation support. That is called social housing and is based on the Act. I do understand you very well when you're saying that we are pushing the agenda towards the rental. But in this instance, I believe that the department also has made strides towards incorporating the cooperatives in other programs. But this is only a piece of what the department has done. In doing its rental housing program, it didn't want to leave the cooperatives on the side. Hence, the presentation says, if you have to be on this program and you have to be accredited. Hence, I even said the economic benefits of this were considered, because what needs to be done, they need to be able to develop, they need to be able to manage, because it will be only rental, and they will be having an opportunity after 15 years to sell it as per Act. That's why I kept on having hiccups, because the model is a little bit difficult. I do understand it in terms of the social housing institutions, but when it comes to cooperatives, there is that thing that the cooperatives are ownership kind of people, but they also want to be involved in rental. They do want to be involved. Hence, we are saying, okay, we are presenting this because it's there, it's regulated. But now it goes back to saying, no, we are cooperatives again, but we can't start with them. Now, it's a pity, DG, that Mr. Mamatipi is not here, because he is the one who presented this model of piloting Gauteng and whatever. we do have people that we know that they are ready to be cooperatives, but the issue of ownership is the issue. But in terms of the Social Housing Act of the department and the social housing policy and guidelines, they have to be able to manage the stock, they have to be involved in rental, they have to be managers, they have to be sustainable. And that will make them qualify in terms of the funding. All the funding support that is there, they will qualify. And that funding support is 60%. And it makes them sustainable. As in terms of rental now, we are not talking about other programs. Yeah, I understand.
What we are saying, we don't have a problem because we know that they have to be empowered. So that if the department is playing that role of building capacity, we appreciate that. If the department is playing a role of providing any support that is required, we don't have a problem. But still, as you are saying, even yourself, you are saying this is an interim, I'm quoting you correctly, you are saying this is an interim measurement because the department has found it necessary to make sure that this sector has been, it has been just kept there. So the DG is trying to pull out that sector to be recognized even within the human settlement. That is why we are saying we appreciate what DG is doing. But we want to put it clear that there has been a sifora into tribulations, libale, kanene. What is a cooperative? Because once you take talk of rental, we are cooperative, the ownership. You are losing the sight. So that is why, let's say, for now, we agree with the initiative or effort that has been undertaken by the department under the leadership of the DG. And we appreciate what DG has done to pull in those people that are responsible, that are playing a part, those stakeholders like SACA, because we believe that even the social housing, that is one of the projects that act. There was that interaction and policy development and so on and so on until we had that act. So that step we are appreciating. But at the same time, we must be cautioned to say, let's keep on. This is the Hamas decision until such time. Because, DG, I think you'll recall, we recommended that in the budget vote, we recommended that at a certain stage, the co-ops, as you did with the sectional title, you have to negotiate with the other departments, the minister has to negotiate with the ministers that the housing co-ops, at least it would be proper if they are managed in the human settlement, so that there is hiccup. But that is a long standing, it's a long term. But for now, we appreciate what you are doing. But it's not only bad, especially NHFC. Let's not pretend as if we don't know what problems have been brought through involvement in NHFC. So, So, it is important to tell those things that are wrong. So this is a multi-genolic. I think we now it is very God bless each other. We are cautioning with it. This thing must be looked at. That is why I propose that we still need a further interaction between ourselves, because this is our baby. This is not your baby only. We are representing the citizens of this country in this parliament. So we have to make sure that their interests are taken into account in a fair manner. So we are assisting each other. We are playing an oversight over what you are doing, but at the same time, we are playing an advisory So it is important that at a certain stage, you remember, we are not here in December in 2009, we had a workshop where we had to have one common understanding on a certain issue, so that when you go and do your policies, we have a common understanding, so that we don't find ourselves the piggy sack, you know. So we appreciate what the department is doing in a nutshell. I think the members don't have a problem on that one, but we have to be cautious. Honourable Bowman?
Chairperson, perhaps to follow up on that, I think it would be, and quality audit, you're absolutely correct, but then would I be correct in saying that we're actually looking here at two different things? The one that the cooperative, such as we understand it, and this one that's all wrapped up in the social housing, the rental. So there's two things, and I think if we get that idea as a basis, then I think we're beginning to be able to clear a little bit.
Okay. No, that's
possibly
the other one. Those are reminding me, because this cooperative, we've even incorporated to the Westers Act ombuds. It is there. You know, in social housing, it is not clear. But you give it a point when you have Zama, we clarify. But social housing, Lusana Lam, Nomita Stay, Nomita Bula, it is not clear. But we appreciate. That is why we are saying if there is a need to revisit SRA, we don't have a problem if it is under SRA, but there should be conditions in clear. Accreditation is fine. But there are other issues that we can look at, because there are some living at Ushra only powers over is cooperative. I don't have a problem in accreditation and regulation, but seemingly, in a condition and I must be open. Condition like Varash, I must remember. And go, must put it in a presentation.
Thank you, Chair. We've been requested to do a presentation on whistleblowing policy for the department. Chair One should indicate that on annual basis this policy is reviewed to ensure its effectiveness when it comes to implementation. the presentation will focus on the latest version that we have since finalized as a department on whistleblowing. I must apologize that the signed version was not sent to all members, but what you'll be getting is a presentation which basically talks to the final version, and we will be forwarding you a comprehensive policy of the department which this presentation informs for your own much more informed understanding of our policy. I will then ask our colleague from the internal audit, Umbongeni, to do the presentation on our whistleblowing policy, which is the version that we are working on as we implement our whistleblowing policy. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and members, for the opportunity. We move directly to the purpose of this presentation. It is basically to brief honorable members on the development and the implementation of anti-fraud and corruption systems and programs within the Department of Human Settlements. We touched briefly on the background on the matter of the department that Human Settlements is responsible for the provision of access to adequate housing and the creation of sustainable human settlements throughout the Republic of South Africa. This responsibility is often derailed by the high levels of fraud and corruption within the Human Settlement Center, including the department. Then we touch also on the background, looking at the processes or the negative impact of fraud and corruption on the provision of access to housing and sustainable human settlement. It impacts negatively on the application and approval of housing subsidies, where we find that at times, the applications are delayed unnecessarily, or one or the other, the outcome tends to not necessarily favor the intended beneficiaries. It also impacts negatively on the tendering processes and awarding of housing contracts, in instances where some members would have an interest in, of course, the awarding of contracts. Thirdly, the manner in which funds get allocated for human settlements, the manner in which those funds are utilized. We have, of course, in the past, or are also been currently dealing with instances where funds are allocated for the provision of housing or for rectification in instances of poor workmanship, where funds were utilized for something else, which, of course, would require further funding of another rectification. We're talking about areas where you have to now rectify another rectification, which is restitution funding. The next one is where the approval of payment and payment of service providers by the relevant officials. You would find that officials within the department, who are dealing with SMMEs, have actually an interest in some of the contracts. They would in one way or the other influence the awarding of contracts. In some instances, the case that is being investigated currently, where the actual cost of providing a service is being inflated, where the service provider would say, I would want, for example, 25,000 rands. The staff member would add another 5,000, it's 30,000 rands, then they get something in return. We have such matters, and there will be prosecution, of the responsible officials. We are also, corruption also impacts negatively on the construction of housing. That particularly refers to the material that has been used, as well as to the workmanship. With regard to materials, you would find that normally the SABS has developed kind of standards to say you need so many bags of cement per certain meter of building sand or river sand. But we find that now, because of the corruption, there's no compliance because material is being stolen and so forth, and the building of shoddy houses. And then lastly, we're looking at the allocation of houses to beneficiaries, where you find that there is involvement of government officials, or some government officials rather, at the three spheres, not different spheres of government, and then that impacts on the provision of housing. As a department, we realize that all these problems necessitated a development and implementation of numerous policies that are aimed at discouraging or dealing with foreign corruption within the sector. One of the policies that were developed and just reviewed annually, as DG has indicated, is the whistleblowing policy. The initial policy was approved in 2007 in November. As a department, human settlements, we realize that our employees, ordinary staff members at operational level, not necessarily management, will be the first persons who will be able to detect and be able to know that there is malpractice or there is corruption taking place, because it's done by some of their colleagues. So they will be at the level where they get to know that information before management becomes aware of that. But the challenge is that, you know, people or staff members would then be reluctant to report those because of fear of being victimized. They could be accused of being, you know, disloyal to their colleagues, if not the manager. Then it becomes then important to ensure that the policy that we have is centered around basic principles, which of course seeks to encourage staff members to come forward and give relevant information. One of the first principles which is regarded as being important is the right of the whistleblower to speak. People should not think that by coming forward they are breaking a law or any policy or regulation of the department. They should know that as citizens, as government officials, as public servants, that they have an obligation or they do have the right, moral obligation, to come out and speak on corruption and from the department. We need to ensure that we encourage transparency and accountability by officials, you know, within the department. We need also to ensure that we promote the disclosure of information. It should not be a once-off incident where when a person bumps into information, they come forward. We need to ensure that in our everyday operations, we always encourage that through different tools, development of pamphlets, the conducting of awareness programs, and actually encouraging these disclosures. And we also need to ensure that there is participation, and that participation is encouraged by assuring or providing protection of the sources of information. Staff members should know that by coming forward, they will be able to retain or keep their positions, because some would say that what's the point of coming forward if it means that tomorrow I will either have to be transferred to another unit, or I might have an opportunity to get a promotion, or I could basically be accused of, you know, being disloyal and leaking information. So we need to ensure that as government, we do protect our sources, that is our staff members. And the next principle, the last one, is that there has to be action, law enforcement. In instances where one has been found guilty of fraud and corruption, there has to be sanctions. We are referring to, one, internal disciplinary measures taken against the said official. Two, criminal prosecution, because corruption in South Africa is a criminal offense. We have legislation that governs that and how it should be dealt with. Three, that we work towards recovering money that were lost as a result of corrupt and fraudulent activities. That four, you could have a combination of the three above, where one could be disciplined, there could be civil action that is aimed at recovering lost funds, as well as, you know, prosecution. Then the legal framework that informs our policy. Our policy tries by all means, or as it is captured, is based on, actually is underpinned by the Protect Disclosure Act, you know, of this country, which defines disclosure of information regarding any conduct of an employer or an employee of that employer, made by any employee who has reason to believe that the information concerned shows or tends to show one or more of the following. One, that a criminal offense has been committed. These will be characteristics of reporting or disclosure. That a criminal offense has been committed or is likely to be committed. This, of course, works towards preventative measures. You don't always have to be reactive. Secondly, that a person has failed or is failing or is likely to fail to comply with any legal obligation to which that person is subjected to. That refers to normal internal procurement procedures. Those were developed, have been approved, they prescribe how things should be done, so failure by an official, definitely so, to comply with those would amount actually to a malpractice. This also would refer to instances where, as officials, we deliberately fail to update the HSS system, you know, which of course also creates challenges in terms of the provisioning of, you know, adequate housing as well as sustainable human settlement. The other characteristic is that there has to be a miscarriage of justice, or that miscarriage has already occurred or is likely to occur. And fourthly, that the environment has been or is likely to be, you know, damaged. Because these things do impact on overall issues of environment. And proceeding, we need also to say that, you know, issues of malpractice, issues of foreign corruption, have also a potential of impacting negatively on people's health and their safety. That should be dealt with as well. We need to ensure that we deal with issues of unfair discrimination. Earlier on, we made an example of people who get an opportunity to get promoted or who could, at the end of the day, be dismissed or suspended because of doing that. That is unfair discrimination and should be dealt with, you know, as such. And lastly, that any matter referred to in the above paragraphs has been or is being or is likely to be deliberately concealed. Then we deal with the how part. Because coming up with a policy not stating how that policy should be implemented could have problems. It is an attempt to simplify, not oversimplify, the processes to ensure that we encourage people that it's not a cumbersome activity to blow a whistle on corruption. The first one is how to make the disclosure. The disclosure could either be made personally, telephonically, or in writing in the following manner. Anonymous complaint or tip-off, open identity complaint or a tip-off, because you do get people who are bold enough to say, I have certain information, I want this thing resolved, and I'm willing to come out, even, you know, expose my identity. And that also that before, this can happen before this thing takes place, and even after it has taken place. So it's never too late, if not too early, to blow a whistle. The next part of the implementation is who can make the disclosure. This refers to departmental employees of human settlements. So the people who can make this disclosure include a staff member or any staff member, regardless of the level, a supervisor, as well as a part of management. Where can the disclosure, you know, be made? There are numerous tools that are used, that are available within our country. We have the National Anti-Corruption Hotline. We have the Departmental Anti-Corruption Hotline. We also have our details, our fax line, where this could be faxed. And people could also visit our offices. But over and above those mechanisms, we also have the Presidential Hotline, you know, which could also be used. Access is also on Facebook as a tool to ensure communication, and that also can be used to report foreign corruption. The next one is the requirement for making the disclosure. Members argue that this is very, very important because there could be a thin line between malicious allegations and reporting, you know, a prima facie case, if not a valid case of foreign corruption. The person who makes allegations or reports foreign corruption should always act in good faith. There should not be any malice on their part. It should not be about settling scores. So the person should act in good faith. Two, that person should have a reasonable belief that his or her allegations are substantially true. That becomes important because when you make accusations of foreign corruption against any official, be it at your level, junior level, or senior level, that has a likelihood of impacting negatively on not only the environment, but that person's reputation and integrity, and also the integrity of the department. Imagine if one makes false accusations, and information one way or the other, we know in government gets leaked deliberately or by mistake, if there is such as leak information by mistake. That information, if it's out in the media or out in the public, it could impact on the people's confidence in government. If it's not handled properly, it could impact on the integrity of that department. Then the next one is that we need to ensure that we comply with the appropriate channels and procedures of lodging the complaints, and that the making of malicious reporting should be discouraged to ensure that we protect our members. On one hand, you want to encourage whistleblowing. On the other, you are trying to put control measures to ensure that people don't just willy-nilly, without checking the facts, make accusations of foreign corruption. Then the next thing, as a department, we had developed an implementation plan. What we did was to link the whistleblowing policy to the general fraud prevention plan and strategy of the department, because they are interlinked. So what the plan seeks to do is to help the department, you know, in ensuring that we identify and address all areas of potential risk. This, of course, speaks to us as actually the Chief Director and Department, ensuring that we update our risk profile with Department and Risk Register, ensuring that as a department, we come up with mitigating, you know, ways, other ways of mitigating the levels of risk from high to low at some point to a zero level. The next one, to ensure that we are able to detect the existence of any activity in the department. How do we detect that? One of the ways of doing that is to introduce, which is part of the plan, random sampling of what the way that is done by procurement officials. We intend once a month to select few files that are dealt with by procurement officials and go through them to ensure that there are no cracks that they picked up, that there are no malpractices in their everyday practices. We also need, actually, in terms of the plan, it seeks to increase the levels of awareness about fraud. And also then we want to establish effective anti-fraud practices, which of course includes the review or annual review of this policy and related policies. As a department, the department has established an internal investigation directorate, which amongst others is tasked with the development and implementation of policies, strategies and other systems that are aimed at preventing, detecting and reducing fraudulent and corrupt activities within the human settlement sector. This directorate is part of an internal audit, risk management, special investigations, chief directorate, which plays the government through the department to ensure that there is compliance with the departmental or government policies and regulations. The directorate within, which is part of the DG's office or branch, you know, has a number of tools that have been put in place. You know. These tools actually will help monitor the implementation of the policy. Policies that get approved, we need to ensure that those policies get implemented. We need every day to be able to do an impact assessment of how effective is that policy and whether we're making inroads in terms of reducing, if not eradicating, fraud and corruption. Then we need to monitor the compliance with the prescript of the policy. They need to ensure that they identify further gaps in the system. That is what DG referred to, the annual review one, because the industry is very dynamic. The people who form part of the sector are people who are into it for money. People are into it, of course, for providing employment and so forth. You know. So if you don't review the police annually, you would find that, you know, gaps develop in the system as well as the policy, because trends are developing every day, within the department, even outside the department. And we need to be able to recommend appropriate intervention, you know, to the government in general and the department. And as we said, there has to be a need to report on the impact. A policy that has no impact or is not effective is as good as the non-existent. So it is our intention and our responsibility to ensure that that policy has an impact. We did indicate that policies are reviewed annually. The current policy that we're presenting on today was, you know, reviewed and approved as recently as March 2011. In conclusion, it is our view that the implementation of this policy, coupled with the fraud prevention strategy and program, will improve the efficiency at the impact of the department on the prevention, detecting, and reduction of fraud and corruption within the human settlement sector. One aside in conclusion, but lastly, there is a need to also share experiences that relate to the policy, what has been achieved so far within the department. We did indicate that earlier on that we have managed to pick up in the department that some of our officials are manipulating the housing subsidy system, which impacts greatly on the provision of housing. We have picked up that there's irregular procurement practices within our procurement department, where some of our officials are called directly by service providers. Some of our officials do that so that they are able to manipulate the system and have contracts awarded to their friends. Some of our officials in the department are involved in price fixing so that their preferred service providers get awarded contracts, you know, before anyone else does actually get contracts. But likely enough, and in line with this policy, members are beginning to come out and say, do more awareness campaigns so that everyone knows about it. But we need to go out and say to everyone that anyone who gets involved in fraud and corrupt activities will be dealt with, because we have a zero tolerance stance as a department on fraud and corruption. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, DG and Bongani. I think they have been a very extensive presentation, and I think from last year when we were in the department, I think it was in August when we were there, and the DG made the commitment to the portfolio committee. If you make a commitment and then you forget that I'm going to make a follow-up for the commitments that you have undertaken and informed us about. So we really appreciate the progress, because you informed us that the policy was there, but it was a little bit outdated, and we were looking at interviewing it, at reviewing it. So I think we appreciate that as the portfolio committee. But I think we need to engage the members. Honorable Jabute, Honorable Jobe, Honorable Siglan, Honorable Tole, to carry more to wound, Honorable Foreman, Honorable Saint, then Quip and Sasan, but Magendu Com, we are Vala. Oh, Honorable Pula, you are the last one. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would first like to welcome this presentation. I've got two questions. I'm interested in this tendering processes and awarding of housing contracts. What happens if a contractor is awarded a contract? Why this contractor is known for its shoddy workmanship? What do you do there? My other question is, your measures to protect the whistleblower, those who doesn't want to be known, what measures do you have in place? Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I know the policy involves those who are within the department, but I'm just worried about what can be the role of other citizens, for instance, in assisting revealing cases of fraud and corruption in the housing department. I am basing this question on the slide. I think it says two, who can make a disclosure. And it states that it's a member of staff, it's a supervisor, and the management. My question is, what about other citizens? Is there any role they can play? And if so, how? And then also, I think it would have been interesting, you know, to support the narrative, which I must say is very interesting, I must say. But it would have been more useful for me if the narrative had been supported in some cases by certain examples or some smaller statistics, like, for example, whether you have actually filed cases resulting from the implementation of this policy, and if so, about how many and what sort of cases of fraud and corruption. And lastly, Chairperson, the policy has been reviewed. I'm just wondering what necessitated the review of the policy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to say thank you very much for this presentation, and it comes at the right time. Secondly, Chair, what makes me happy is that is going to investigate the same people who's giving the right to the poor outside. And, you know, it's long in over what you say, now these challenges are there, and even contractors outside, they know there are people who are selling the contracts to them from the inside. The other thing, Chairperson, that worries me, we've got SIU that is working with the department. Are they also involved in this? Then lastly, Chairperson, we've got entities from the government that are also doing wrong things. What do we do about them? Because if you look at the shoddy work that has been done by the contractors outside, the department repeat to give them contracts. And NHBRC is there. What is their role in this? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair President. I'm not feeling well today, Chair. Chair, I think this policy was established in 2007. But we want to find out what achievement have you made in the department, and how many cases do you have, if there is any cases, and what I want to find out about that review of police, the impact that it do have for the wearing of this police. And another one, Chair, I think, no, that's fine.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. I also just want to concur with the member who's mentioned the query on other people coming in other than staff to report, to do some whistleblowing. I think this is probably the department or the area, the sector, that I think if we were to measure corruption and fraud and everything, this is where it actually all stems from. So this is an extremely important document. And in the, since we're talking about the policy, I would just like to know, in the annual review that happens, and it's just happened now in March 2011, what are the significant changes that are being made to the policy? Because if this has been policy since 2007 and we still have the huge amount of corruption and fraud, I would like to know now, what is the difference that this particular policy is going to make? Then I think I would like to ask, you've rightly pointed out that people get nervous about whistleblowing for various reasons. And some of them may not even know their protections. What sort of education are we doing on this so that people do understand their rights as a whistleblower and that they don't need to worry about that? Yeah, and then I want to just talk about this comment about the willy-nilly under the requirements for making disclosure. And I was going to say that I've forgotten what I was going to say about it. I'll come back in another round. The willy-nilly.
First of all, I want to ask if this is obviously the national department's policy. Does it apply to all the agencies that report to the minister, irrespective of whether they've got their own policy? Because I would imagine that every department, every agency, as part of their risk management responsibilities, would need to have something similar. But in the event of them not having something, does this apply to any of the agencies that report to the department? Then you've spoken about where and to whom disclosures can be made. I would imagine that if a disclosure is made, for example, to the chairperson,
and she then brings it to the department, that it still falls within your policy. It doesn't necessarily have to come directly from the employee, say, to the department. There could be a third party involved, and it could be a member of the public. It doesn't even have to be the chairperson. Then I want to, one of my colleagues asked for some sort of examples and said if they were narratives, she would understand it better. I want to just give you a hypothetical, and I stress the word hypothetical situation, and I'd like to hear what the response is. Where you've got an employee that goes and discloses things of a fraudulent nature, and the it's actually proven to be there, there's proof, so it's not just guesswork. And you then have senior officials that bring disciplinary hearings against a person that they believe to be the whistleblower, under the disguise that they brought the department, the agency, whatever it is, into disrepute. And the senior official then uses money from the agency for this disciplinary hearing, which runs into hundreds of thousands of rands. And actually, this is where the question about the responsibility of the accounting officer comes in. For the purposes of this meeting, it's hypothetical. Where the official then uses money from that particular department to get this supposedly whistleblower. Now, what is the, in terms of using that funds? Is that not wasteful expenditure, for example? But there is a scenario that I've skipped hypothetically, and I want you to answer on that. Can that agency, can that official actually then do that? Where's the protection in terms of your policy that they now bring in disciplinary measures on the understanding that they think it's the whistleblower? They don't even know. Then, you mentioned, and I'm sorry to bring this up, Chair, I brought it up previously as well with the other policy. No, I'm sticking to this one now. What was said was the department is in the process of developing monitoring tools. Now, it's a sort of word that my ear immediately catches, because the policy was started in 2007. You're talking about annual review. I find it hard to review something that you've not been monitoring, either the success or failure. And by your own admission, you're saying you are in the process of developing monitoring tools. And some of my colleagues ask questions about what is the outcome of this policy have been. Now, if you're in the process of developing the tools to monitor, I would imagine you can't tell us what the outcome has been. And linked to that, I want to put it to you, through you, Chairperson, that what was also said was that the officials picked up this manipulation of the subsidy system and they then acted upon it. I'm actually putting it to you, that came as a result of an Auditor General's report, specifically looking at the subsidy system. I think it was in 2007. Otherwise, it looks like it would have slipped through the cracks and the department would never have been aware of it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I want to understand, Didi, that I would assume that after a thorough evaluation and investigation of the various other entities that are lined to deal with all the concerns that you've listed here, you have come up with this kind of mechanism. It won't be fair to interrogate this now. But one thing for sure, repeatedly in this committee we raise the issues about fraudulent tenders, shoddy workmanship, 1.8 billion, the national minister called for a national audit. But I see, as some of the members also referred to as the manipulation of officials, manipulating the subsidies and all of this. I want to understand and digest that after you have seen the weaknesses of the monitoring of the other entities, you have come up with a revised idea to deal with these kind of issues. Now, will it work? We haven't tested it. So let us not once again put the cart before the horse. The other issue that I'm completely concerned about, I would want to believe, Madam Chair, that in the very same context where the Minister of Planning Commission that says that the growth is a long-term process, what is your time frame? In this instance here, we cannot say that this will be implemented in the next 6 months, because there are crucial issues that the DG has raised in this year. But what impressed me very, very good was to curb the rot. But I think in this presentation, Madam Chair, one point is missing. Throw the criminals in jail and throw the keys. Chairperson, you know, we were speaking in the presentation here that there might be limitations in view of the fact that if people come out with relevant information, they are protected by certain legislation. Have you thoroughly engaged with the other departments, like the Department of Justice, to see what is their rights? What I'm trying to get at here, it's pointless coming up with a brilliant idea and say you want to curb the issue of fraud and corruption, but the system does not allow you. Have you engaged with... let me make an example. Can I, Madam Chair? Very quickly. The issue of the classified information in the media, the information bill that is a public domain now. It's important, Madam Chair. And some of the information was that that journalists might not come up front because it's classified information and they might be imprisoned. And therefore an amendment suggested that you should go to the Administrative Justice Act. Now that is the predicament that you are precisely in here in terms of those people that will come up with that information. How are you going to deal with these issues as a matter of from a legal perspective? Let me wrap up here. Yeah, I think the other one has been raised. If all of this is not linked to the SIU and your other components that will, your sister components that will assist you to finally or ultimately deliver on this year, what are the challenges in the other areas that you foresee which you'll want the community to interact and engage with? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. My colleagues have said the mouthful. I just want to know on this one about the quality of material, because different contractors use different material from different service providers. So there are so many houses built with low quality standard of material. So do you have any model in place, maybe, to try and enforce contractors to use quality material? The other one is about allocation of houses to beneficiaries. And I also would like to know if you've got any model, maybe, to check that, because that one is a serious problem and it takes so many years to be resolved. Thank you.
I think we can get the responses. But before we that, I wanted to check from the... Okay.
Thank you, Chip. Sorry, you've got to make it last for the Madala brain, you know, when I forget things. Yes, I just want to that requirements for making disclosure and the willy-nilly comment that was made about that. I would imagine
that it would be quite important, and I understand what you're saying about that, in that you don't want people just willy-nilly coming with their complaints and laying aspersions on people's characters and so on. But how would you differentiate somebody dropping something in your lap? Would that be something that you would follow up on, or just regard it as maybe some silly soul, you know, or trying to make trouble kind of a person?
Chef, if you allow me just to make one comment, and just Director General, I think we'll address this matter, because there are existing anti-fraud and corruption policies in all organs of state. But the problem still happens. I think the point that was raised earlier on, what difference really between your 2002 and the one that is reviewed now? What is it going to make this one work if the previous one didn't work? Because the review is precisely because there were problems. And but also Director General, I think the bigger problem for many of us, and then also Chair, having listened to Comrade Manuel raising the issue of the NPC report around the state of corruption, generally speaking, and perception, but the reality of corruption is another problem. And to me, the comment that I wanted to make sure is that I think it would be important for Director General, because there are a lot of things that you do national, but by the real work is subnational. The real tender issue is subnational. Because you give money to provinces, now you are going to give money to the districts and metros. Those are the ones really who are giving out the real big tenders. Of course, we may also give in tenders of water, I'm not sure. But general also, is it not really we should try to synchronize the prevention of corruption by any organ of state that you give money to? First thing that they should show you is that they do have an effective policy to fight against corruption. It's one of your requirements, because the money really that we are getting here, not 32 billion, whatever, is really spent somewhere in provinces. A lot of large money is in Durban, in Cape Town, in other areas. But we are not really ensuring that as we give them this money, but also they really commit themselves to implement. I'm aware of the separations of things, independent. I'm aware of that. But I'm saying that because we are the ones who are giving money. And a lot of this money, even these houses anyway that are rebuilt and rebuilt, they were not built necessarily by national. Many of them were built by provinces and some cities. Therefore, the real problem to me is that how do we then synchronize this matter? Ensuring that if I give you 50 million rand, you must also show me that you do have a very effective anti-corruption policy. To ensure that the man that I'm giving you is not going to misuse by other processes. To me, sure, that's what I wanted to make it as a point. Because you are much more advantageous because it's a concurrent function. But you give money. Therefore, you can't just give money without following the money that is spent correctly in all levels that we give the money to. I think we should consider that, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Richard. I think we refer to the disclosure, the that act. I don't know whether this policy has been selective. I'm not sure because I've not yet through the act per se. But I want to check if it is not selective. Has this considered all the issues that are raised in that act? And I think the issue of saying a person is bringing a baseless. I just checked this document in the human whole lab, but I sent something that says in this special golden policy, under purpose and scope of this policy, then there's the baseless reporting. I don't know. How do you come to that decision that this reporting is baseless? Because for me, you have to undertake certain processes to ensure that that information is invalid. And the second point is on the part of the whistleblower, because I think it is clear that the whistleblower can raise an issue because he believes. So when somebody believes, so he perceives that a certain conduct is illegal or a certain conduct is immoral or unethical. So that's what I believe. So you have to make sure that you don't undichuchise. What you need to do, you have to make sure that you clear my mind that my belief was wrong, so you don't come into conclusion of punishing. I think that is the aim of the legislation. That is why the whistleblowers are protected by the Act. So I don't know, because I have not read this document, but I think we still have to engage. We still have a lot of platforms where we can engage with the document. Otherwise, we appreciate your initiative. We're not saying it is wrong, but what we are saying, there are issues we believe that they have to be considered in this policy, because that Act is clear. It says the senior managers, they threaten the staff. So it's that they fear to raise the issue. I was listening to Bongani, when I was raising this issue, maybe I might be wrong. I could feel that maybe he's defensive somehow. I don't know. When you must be impartial when we are dealing with these matters. And we must ensure that the rights of the whistleblowers are being protected. So I don't feel any protection of the whistleblower, apparently won't buy whistleblower, it is a culture, according to this policy. I don't feel that within the department, staff members are free to do so. Seemingly it is confrontational or defensive. I don't know. That's how I might be wrong. I'm not saying I'm judging. That's how I perceive. I'm one of the people who are perceiving this policy. So the issue of the external, there's something about the external, something that is regarded. I want to know who is commanding, who is commanding. But there's something, what is a general external protected disclosure? So this one is different from what the members have been raising. If you are looking at this one, it is saying general protected disclosure is a much wider disclosure when a whistleblower is not making an internal disclosure, but rather making a wider disclosure to the law enforcement agency. So it does not relate to a person who comes, just an ordinary citizen. You know, to the SAPS, but he believes that he can approach the department itself. He believes that if I approach the department, the department will deal with this matter. So it does not relate to that circumstances. So somebody becomes lucky if he comes across a member of parliament or any other citizen who does assist him to phone the department to say, that's the issue, and then the department will take it up from there. But most of the people, they don't have that that lucky to be exposed in those scenarios. So I think we, as one thing, that we are still going to engage. For instance, the issue of the where can the disclosure be made? I think it's very limited. The staff have got a right to approach a senior within the department. You don't have to go to the toll-free only. So for me, it is very limited. So it does not give space for the staff members to directly interact, I mean sensitize the senior managers to say, no, even if you are not disclosing the whole issue, you have to say, can you just be sensitized on this matter? Because I think the act is clear, the 2000 and the Disclosure Act, it is clear. So I would suggest that let's try and look at the document. Let us be given an opportunity to look at this document that has been given us so that we continue to interact. Otherwise, we do appreciate the work that has been done. We are not criticizing, but we are saying, let's look at other issues of which we believe that they are very crucial to ensure that this process is managed in a fair and just and also transparent manner. So, yes, within the department itself, people must be free to raise these issues. It's just because the environment does not allow them. So, and then we come up and blame them. But it's long, it's the environment here to be right. This is just a summarize from the comments, and then I think we are taking time for another session. We've got a lot of sessions today.
Sure, thanks. I think there are many questions that have been raised. I think the issue of a whistleblowing policy is quite a very complicated matter. I think one should admit that. And the presentation focused mainly on the tools as well for implementation, as per the reviewed policy. And that is upon the realization that if you don't have effective tools to implement the policy, chances are you may not realize your underlying objective of the same policy. So that's why we have made that point. And it's a fair comment that in the past, part of the failure to effectively implement the policy was around the implementation strategy of the policy in terms of the policy instruments, that is the tools now that you need to make it effective. And I think that is very fundamental. But Chair, I will take your point. Maybe we'll forward the comprehensive document to all members to also get a much broader framework in the policy that we have worked on, and maybe based on that we can come and deal with the issues that members have raised, having read that policy, because I've just signed that document myself and give it to members. But having said that, Chair, I think synchronization of policies generally within the sector is very critical, and that relates to the issue raised by Honourable Member Steyn. I think it's important to understand that it's a national department policy, but you'd like to begin to develop a situation where different agencies and institutions that exist within the sector apply the same policy framework within which we do our things. I think that is very fundamental. As it stands, our policies are very fragmented, so they are not integrated, and that creates a problem. That's why you find that different agencies within the same sector respond differently on certain policy issues, even disciplinary issues, and part of this, as you have raised, the hypothetical issue, requires synchronization. So we do have a responsibility at national level and through our MINMEC structure to begin to synchronize our policies into the one center of human settlements, so as to avoid a situation where the department has a different policy in place and other agencies have their own policies, but they are not talking to the same. Instead, they contradict one another. It's the fragmented nature of the way our sector is currently operating. We are working towards eliminating that kind of arrangement. That's why we are effectively now engaging with all agencies within the sector so that we understand what they're doing, they understand our policies, and we try to integrate them. That will avoid a situation where, as a department, we do something. A classic example, Chair, with the time constraints that we have, we deal with our issues with SIU, as you know. We don't have the capacity to implement our policies. But different agencies have their own policies of dealing with similar issues in terms of protecting certain information. Now, then you get into a contradiction. When does certain information becomes protected within an agency? Because we have taken the information to SIU to say, please investigate, because we don't have a capacity. And we pay SIU quite a substantial amount of money, as we presented to you before, to do this work. But when it goes to different agencies, if it's linked to them, you find there are certain existing policies that contradict our own policy from the department, and it creates tension to some degree. So we've got to synchronize our policies with institutions. I will recommend you, because if we were to go to every question that has been raised, really it will take your time. Let me forward that document, because it was just a presentation from that document. Maybe you give us another time, members would have read it, and then come back to you, and we take the comments made, and maybe that could also add to that. Because that's a final version that we have revised for your information.
Thank you very much, DJ. I think this session is over now. We are going to release the members of the department because we are going to have another session. Just for the members, let's just have a 5-minute comfort break so that we welcome our next guest. I think let's, the portfolio committee, let's take the opportunity to welcome the minister in the meeting. Minister, it's not the first time you are with us. We appreciate your response, and we all understand that you are a busy person. You have been tasked with so many responsibilities by the organization as well as government. So we appreciate the time that you have, you know that you have to account. So we appreciate that you give, you honor that responsibility. Just in short, Minister, we have invited you. You know that we normally invite you when we feel that we want to brief you about something, or we would like you to brief us about something, or even yourself, you have got an obligation or a responsibility to ensure that if you feel that you want us as this portfolio committee, you invite us so that we give you that opportunity. So that working relationship, I think it is very much important that we have kept. Initially, the issue is about the program, the sanitation program. It's a newly transferred function to the human settlements. And we have been engaging with the department from last year, and with the understanding, we all agree that this is a new program, and it needs time to be implemented. But unfortunately, there are funds that have been deployed to this program, so we could wait for more, because we do have funds in our position, so we had to implement the program. But we have observed the milestones within the program itself. and some of our of the programs, the milestones that we have observed as the portfolio committee, we fully agree that there are challenges. For instance, there have been challenges that have been mentioned about the staff members that are reluctant to be transferred. We are all aware of the functions and so on. But I think it was important for us, as we were interacting with the department, there's quite a lot of challenges that we observed. So we felt that we must share with you those challenges. This time it's us who are sharing with you, it's not you. We have to share those challenges so that you look at them. And as an accounting officer, and executive, as an executive authority, you attend to them. But I'm not going to dwell much. The Honorable Richard is going to just make a background, and as well as the members are going to make an input, but I don't want to open this much. The other issue, Minister, I've spoken to this with you to say, although it is not in our program, in our agenda, we received a report at this portfolio committee from Honorable State that he is being under attack from one of the agencies that are reporting to the department. So as Parliament, when there is such a matter that affects one of the members, there are rules of Parliament that are there where we need to apply as the portfolio committee. But we felt that before we do that, let's inform you formally. Let's share with you this information that there's this, but you are not going to let it to be dealt with. You just want to get an information, but not in detail. If there are issues that you feel that are still under what is this prejudice, this English thing, legal thing. So, So we are not going to allow you to put pressure on you to talk about them. But just raise the comment so that when we report to Parliament about this matter, because the rules wants us to report the matter. Okay, Honorable Richard, let me give it to you. Everybody is welcome. Don't get delegation, the minister. Minister, don't get a delegation, yeah.
Yeah, I think you have really covered all the board. Maybe I shouldn't consume much more time, except just to take one point. For the minister, I think, was talking to saying this when he comes in, that he belongs to this committee. He's a member of this committee, the fact that he's a member of Parliament. He can attend meeting of this committee even if uninvited. As a member of Parliament, deployed to the executive. And we think we appreciate that, Honourable Minister. In fact, I think it should be a spirit, and I hope you'll organize a workshop in the executive and invite the chairperson to come and address it. The point that we're also raising really is that we do understand exactly that there are issues that the committees. You do have a report as a committee that you wanted to present to you for your perusal and consideration. And then, of course, not prescribing anything, but giving our own observation as a committee on areas that we think are very critical. And then moving from a premise that sanitation is a very important Millennium Development Goal. Therefore, we can't downplay the importance of sanitation. And we raise the issue that we are aware that, of course, it's just transferred to the department and then recently. Therefore, the department must build some capacity, because I don't think we'll transfer it again back to where it comes from. Simply means that it's something that now is with us. Therefore, the department itself must work on it to build the capacity of the sanitation sector. We think that is important for us to do so. Mindful of the fact that the large areas of our rural communities, really, the question of sanitation becomes a critical area, not just for sanitation per se, but the entire health of people. Sometimes got affected in sanitation, the schools, everywhere. and then I, of course, Honorable Minister, ourselves and yourself too, we have been visiting many communities. I think what we are saying, you will also attest to it, that there are real challenges around sanitation, and then that we have to address. And then we have observed something, the capacity of the agencies, and not just one agency to us, we're talking about agencies that are come to your department, and then all of them assisting as leaders of the committee to execute our mandate. And of course our mandate differs from your mandate because you implement and you oversee your implementation. Therefore, as we oversee your implementation, we may also come to conclusion that some of the things are not going according to what we think should be. Therefore, we'll raise these matters openly this meeting and ensure that then we present our own observation. These observations, they will assist all of us, particularly the department, to ensure that in other areas where there are complaints, that those complaints are addressed urgently, also they are addressed in a manner that speed up the delivery of services to deserving communities. I think that's a point shared because the report really is well written, is there, and hopefully then we'll be able to have a discussion with the minister, taking the point that you have raised, really, that there may be other matters that may be subject to care, and therefore it may not be discussed in a broader meeting like this. But whatever issue and the policy issues, really, because members also are much more concerned about policy issues and directives in terms of ensuring that we achieve the Millennium Goal around the sanitation. Given the fact that, Chair, I'm told that also you are inviting us to Kigali, I think now is day 21, and that is around the African sanitation. It seems, in my view, Chair, it's much more important than ourselves here. It could assist us a lot to have a thorough discussion, even Chair, when you go to Kigali, if he's able there to address some of the challenges, our own experiences in the South African context around the issue of sanitation. We have cited a lot of other issues that we have seen, the implementation, implementing all the agencies of the state, the capacity thereof, and other problems, the people's participation, sometimes delays around the question of implementation based on the agreement with the people. Because again, we are mindful as a committee that people's involvement in decision making is a very difficult exercise because no community is single-mindedly dealing with this matter. A lot of diverse interests. It sometimes it delays the implementation of some of the programs. We are mindful of that. Then our recommendations, Chair, that are based really on our concerns and observation over some time around some of these issues. We are also taking a view that it's a new program. Therefore, you are not preempting some of the structure that may be set down to address some of these challenges. There are a lot of observations that we are cited, Chair, and I think the Minister will have a report, I think, already. And then our recommendation, Chair. I think to me would be a good idea, Chair, if the Minister can also comment generally on a general observation, but also on the recommendation. Because we would really take a view, generally, that once the recommendations are accepted by the House, they become mandatory to departments. Our view is always that we mustn't make any recommendation that is beyond the scope of a department. Because once we have accepted them, they become almost a law in terms of implementation in the House. That's why we always entertain the question, discussion open, whatever recommendation that you are putting forward. Chair, I think those are issues that I wanted just to comment on them. But colleagues are here, they've observed a lot of things.
I think you're not
going to
have lengthened this. I think the Minister has captured the gist, I'm not sure. Minister, would you like to get another? Because my issue is the time.
Can you ask me?
Have something to say.
Thank you, Chairperson. As usual, a very open portfolio committee. Multi-party committee, but also very inspiring to work with this committee because the cardinal principle is that we keep everything just above board. So rest assured, continue resting assured, that as minister, I'm first and foremost, and I want to say, because I know we were talking lightheartedly earlier, but for the record, I'm first and foremost your colleague as a member of parliament. That's why today, when we all rise, we go to parliament and discharge our responsibilities there. And that's why I say, as a member of this committee, I come with that hat. At the same time, I am mindful that I am also a member of the executive and I have to account here. So I participate as a member, but I also account. And I'm not trying to account because we're not dealing about private matters of my friends out there. We're dealing about public interest matters. I get the budget from yourself. You vote for it. You have every reason to demand from this minister, and any minister, for that matter, for the budget that you vote for. Having said that, I feel very welcome, and always know that the engagement, no matter how robust, and I welcome that one, because if I don't know from you, then I don't know what you are saying and where we may not be going right. You can trust your chairman always to be shouting on the phone. I wouldn't organize a workshop here of the executive. I don't want to put my executive, several members of the executive, under this pressure. I take it on their behalf from this chairperson. The question of sanitation is seen or needs to be seen as part of the broadening of the mandate of the department or the ministry from housing to human settlement. Just one of the new additions. The transfer of this function from the Department of Water Affairs to human settlements has not been an easy one. But of course, there's nothing wrong with that, because the transfer of any function from one department to the next is a major responsibility. Such a shift means that you transfer people, you transfer funds, you transfer officials, tools, including, you transfer legislation, and you transfer lots of rules and procedures attached to such legislation. And the president did that with the proclamation. But we also had to have a building to include the new people. We're happy with that. Fine. Sanitation, and I just want us to draw on an article which was written, I believe it was yesterday or day before yesterday, it's very recent, or it was in the media, by the Crown Prince of the Netherlands. Those of you who have seen this article, do acquaint yourself with it. Mr. Janji, if or Chief of Staff, just check that article. It's one of the newspapers. It could have been the New Age of the Sunday Times, I'm not sure. But the Crown Prince of Netherlands is on behalf of a body that he serves in, or the United Nations, in respect of the Millennium Development Goals, pointed out that the whole world is experiencing challenges to the extent that more than 2 billion people still do not have proper sanitation worldwide. I'll stop there about the world. Our own country is included in that number. And this minister has got to find out how many people within South Africa require to have the satisfaction of sanitation. Now, there's something I would like us to differentiate. Sanitation, as in sanitation, where people have got, they need quality sanitation, they require proper bathrooms, proper toilets. And I don't want to mix the topic of sanitation that we're discussing here with the open toilet saga. You see, the open toilet saga is something else. These are things that should not have happened. You just provide sanitation, but it becomes undignified. That was wrong. And I said, we are going to pursue that right to the end, and I would like this portfolio committee to stay in the course with me. That was wrong. But also, that should not become a political football. Because once you kick it at Makaza, you end up with it at Mukaka. So we thought it was in Western Cape at Makaza, it was at Mukaka. So, and I think it should have been a lesson to all South Africans. Don't laugh when wrong happens. Maybe the period of the local government elections, you know, it's quite tempting for people to have utilized that. But immediately I thought you should know. My job is not that one. My job is the one associated with this 2 billion number in the world and to identify our own numbers in our own country and address those numbers to the budget that is provided. And yet, sanitation was provided, but it was undignified. And it must be stated. I said immediately when this thing came up, I called the DG to write immediately during the elections to all premiers, all HODs, tell me how many other areas do have this kind of open toilets. Because the sanitation is provided, where are those, where's the cover, where's the protection, where's the comfort by people? And I found that it's in only these two areas. No, I'm sure the world would have thought that every toilet in South Africa was open. I had to check on your behalf how many other areas are experiencing this. And I found that it was Makaza in Western Cape and Mukaka in the Free State. I will not mention the names of the political parties that confronted one another on these questions. I hope we've all learned in Mbale in total share. Do not laugh at the soul of another person. But I hope that it's passed. But the lessons that must be drawn is that our people should come first. Politics aside, our people delivery must come first. So this minister makes an assurance. We will search. I have asked every province to tell me if there is this kind of a problem anywhere else. And I was assured that no other places. So we can put that aside. But before putting it aside, I said I am going to implement the decisions of the Cape High Court on Makaza to apply throughout the country, at Mukaka. And we have said the companies that are involved in these types of projects, particularly that Free State company, because it was 2004, imagine where each one of us was, our chairman of private sector company. It happened 2004, that Makaza, it just happened now, recently. That one is old. We want to make a call through yourselves as you visit. I know you go to Rwanda. Please also, your other responsibilities in your own country. Help me to help the people on your behalf. The communities there must also take responsibility. From the year 2004, toilets in front of you are open. Where's your own participation? Where's the councillor? Forget the councillor. Somebody should have raised the alarm at that time to say, since 2004, this is the situation. Communities should also take responsibility for raising the red flag against this type of thing. Had the people reported, sent through hotlines, come to the portfolio committee, go to the premiers and so on, there is, this thing would have been sorted out long before. But we are asking, and I'm sure there are very good reasons, somebody in the community would say, we reported and we became tired. I'm sure people always come with good reasons when things are wrong. But we are asking through you, raise your voice to help that of the minister. Communities must help us hold one another accountable right at the beginning of delivery. Because we hear holding the minister accountable, but look how far the chain is to a one toilet covered by grass in Hamadullah's dorp. That's it. People must raise the alarm. And please,
would like also that we should have this hotline of the ministry. See, call them. Here's the number. Call them. Call Dr. Swan himself, because he was talking here. Let's see what he'll say to you. I think if we're told that time, this thing would not have remained the way it was. But that is the two situations which were about sanitation provided, but in an undignified manner. The worst situation is that we are still now having real sanitation challenges with the bucket system. Even if they are covered, those, the bucket system or people who are using holes on the ground, that's where the job is. This transfer of sanitation that has come to us addresses all that, with proper toilets and so on. The transfer of these functions, as you indicated, colleagues, has not come easy. But we also have reluctance on the part of officials. You know, an official joins the department of DTI, and then certain functions of the DTI are transferred. There is an application of brakes, and people do go slow to make sure that they can tomorrow say this should not have been transferred, because people want to secure their jobs. And one can understand, not agree with such things, but understand that you applied, you have your own technical expertise or a degree, you wanted to work under the Ministry of Finance, and suddenly you are told that, no, you are going to DTI. And that's not why you joined government. So people will have that. But I think the interest of this government comes first. Once the president has proclaimed, people must fall in line. We found that we had a problem with some of the people who were feeling we should the president should not have proclaimed this. But also the transfer of the functions had left certain details back there in water affairs. We should have been this side. Now, you cannot have this thing without water reticulation, right? Is that what you're saying, Richard? Water reticulation. You understand what that means? Yeah. What has happened?
I have said,
but you are also the temperature, you guys.
I was trying to be flexible,
yeah.
Minister.
Yeah. I know portfolio committees where a minister will come and say, hey, how was it? Volcano. No, we have not had eruptions here. Yeah. So I'm saying there's that aspect as well, where certain little details should have come so that the full function can be operational this side. Then there's the point of implementation. Colleagues, the problem is that you sit here and you have got to implement through other people on the ground. That's where the difficulty and challenges of government. Now, there are provinces with their premiers and executive authority in the MECs, and then the MECs, there are cities, there are councillors, and so on. And these changes in government, these constant changes, also disturb delivery. Because you've got a new mayor, you've got a by-election, you've got a new councillor, and so on. So we've got to come to terms with how this can be done best. Last but not least is the question of who provides the service there on the ground. Now, there's been a contentious issue around the appointment of the IDT. People have raised concerns, if you think that was, but they were raising concerns in the wrong way. See, first and foremost, the IDT is an organ of government. The worst thing would be to take government contracts and quickly give them to the private sector. I would never support that. I would want the IDT to fail completely before we do such a thing. So it's important that the IDT, and I have spoken with Minister Mashango, the IDT needs to jack its work up. Insofar as this agency is concerned in respect of implementation, there is a need for the IDT to jack its act up. Now, the problem is that it doesn't fall under human settlements, correctly so. So you don't have authority over it. The new minister, Gabinde, Masango Gabinde, is in conversation with me about how best, and she has also made a statement about the less than best effective approaches that we use at the IDT. I'm sure there are many very good people in the IDT, but its systems must change. Because we hear that in some areas that are getting behind. The problem is that you have given money down there, and people have passed it on to others until it gets to municipalities. So you've got to wait to get those reports about what that agency is doing down there. I think there's a need for a great improvement in the correction of systems and structures within the IDT, the way I hear reports. But the minister and I, Gabi Masan, are together on this one, that this organ must operate optimally. It's not broken, no. It has got serious challenges and difficulties. And I think they need to up their game here. But what would be improper in terms of good governance is for officials within my government, within my department, to take action against the IDT without the minister having decided. That would be improper. That would be severely improper. Now, there's an official who has been doing things the wrong way. You see, all fly SAA. If you've got problems with the SAA, it's just an example, you don't write letters to all his clients to stop using it. It's a government organ. This lady started writing letters, wrong, unlawful, unconstitutional, dereliction of duty. That and other letters led to her suspension. It's a good person, but it's a wrong act. And none of you here can ever stand up to write a letter to all the customers of SAA because you've got a problem with SAA. You've got to fight the SAA to make sure that this government agency is correct. Before you go to customers, let alone even having an inkling of sending contracts to the private sector. So the minister will never support the movement of contracts to the private sector. I come from there, I understand. Before we finalize whatever needs to be corrected within a state agency, it would be wrong. It's unprofessional, it's illegal, it's not governance, it's not acceptable. So I'm saying we have had that kind of situation, and the person concerned had to be suspended for that and other reasons. You fix it, you don't go and undermine it. Particularly something happening to another minister. I would never stand up here and have an official within this department attacking another minister. Something which is being controlled by other ministers elsewhere. You talk to the minister first. I don't read these things in newspapers for the first time. So I'm saying there was that bit of a challenge. We are attending to this case, and as soon as the DG and then have resolved this matter, you'll be informed. Very, very last point is to say that I want to come and give you a briefing. The question asked today, this is about sanitation, about the NHBRC. I want to put it like this. There are things that this minister dislikes and are shocking. I know it's not the topic today, but I am making an application to also come and see you about the NHBRC. Mr. Stein, you raised some issues. The question that you asked in Parliament, I'm sure I'm answering one of your questions today, is very little compared to what I'm dealing with now. I want to come and take you into confidence about what I have discovered. Because that organ is the one that we must rely upon to solve problems of housing, including sanitation, because everything that we build, that's the police of human settlements. I do have a problem. Today I dispatched correspondence to the chairperson of the NHBRC. very serious correspondence today in association with the investigation that has been launched by the SIU. I've been talking to them. I'm satisfied that I'm going to move now. But I want to come and brief you about that one as soon as next week. As soon as next week. That's what it means. So we find if it's what is this day, another day. If we are here another Wednesday next week, I hope the cabinet is inside. Use this time again so that I can come and give you a proper briefing. And these are also things which will affect the performance of sanitation, because this affects the police department, the real FBI of human settlements. If that one doesn't work, we are going to have a problem. I've discovered things which are shocking, and there have been things that, out of that shock, have developed with people trying to cover their tracks. Don't worry, I know the tracks now. I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Minister. The members would like to make just the interaction with the Minister's response. Honorable Bowman, Honorable Stein, Honorable Bula.
Thank you, Chairperson. And
I forgot to say something. You know, when you're a minister, you get love letters even from each one of you. I know there's a question from this one. From this one. Just know that I talk with you all the time. I know all the from Chairperson. So they only say, please next time send them with photographs and smile.
Thank you to the Minister also for his honesty in coming to this committee. And let me assure you that the Honourable Stain has a photograph taken of me outside a rotten-looking toilet on a new development. And I'm sure he's going to talk more about it. I just want to talk about the photograph that you're referring to. He's got one of me. And I thought he was going to use it in the elections, but he didn't use it. So, Minister, I just want to say that, you know, for this committee, and I think we're all of one mind here, for us it is, as the President has charged us, about service delivery. It's getting delivery to the people on the ground. And I want to just refer very briefly to this whole situation with RDT, and that is, and I hear your point about, you know, we've got to fix it. We've been trying to deal with this since last August. Realizing the problems that they were with this particular agency. And then I think there comes a point where we have now prepared the report and you know, we've brought it to you. And I think that is the right way to go about it. And so I would say to you, we would like to see this thing fixed, but only this morning we had Treasury here. And they're talking about huge amounts of money that are being forwarded up front for this agency. And, you know, people are then at risk for allowing that to happen, you know, our accounting officers. And I think our point is, how do we get this agency then to function? That's why we're coming to you, in your department, to say to you, please, we had... less than 50%, I think, delivery last year. 50% delivery, you know, on sanitation. Now, that's not delivery for us as human settlements. And so that is our concern.
Thank you, Chairperson. I equally want to say that I understand the Minister's reluctance to take a contract away from a government agency. However, I must also state unequivocally that if that agency is not delivering, then the people that depend on that service simply cannot wait for the agency to be jacked up. The fact of the matter is, Minister, that the agency doesn't depend just on this contract for them to be active. We heard this morning, and Honorable Bowman referred to it, they're involved in roads, they're involved in all sorts of things, where at the end of the last financial year,
they got 2.6 billion rand from 18 different departments that was basically dumped, and yet the work wasn't done. So I put it to you, Honorable Minister, that there is no time to get this agency jacked up to do sanitation. They, what is shocking for us is that they were the, they've got a tender for this, so it's not like it is their primary responsibility. They tendered for this contract. It was indicated in the tender document that they did not have the experience in sanitation, so they should never even have been entertained. They got a, what was initially 55 million rand contract, which was then 45 million, because we keep on getting different figures, which they could not do. And yet the new financial year, their part of the second phase is over 300 million. The total contract is 550 million. It's not going to happen, Honorable Minister. Our suggestion, after looking very carefully at the various reports, is that they should finish, and it's one of the recommendations in the 14 that we've got, and I'm referring to recommendation 6, and Chairperson, for what it's worth, I still stick by that, that they should be given the opportunity to finish the phase 1 of their contract, but that they should not get phase 2. Another different service provider can do it, or in fact two other service providers. Why do we have to stick to two when we've got 1.2 billion rand to spend on sanitation, when we can have four or five service providers and get four times the amount of service delivery within any one financial year? Now, Chairperson, I'm fortunate that we also had that whistleblower thing here this morning. And what I'm going to do now, I'm doing under the protective disclosure. And the minister spoke about photographs and so on. And the members, if you go back to your DG, he will tell you that we have asked again and again, tell us where these projects take place so we can go there, we're going into constituency, we can get people in our various constituencies to go and have a look and see what's happening. Well, Honorable Minister, I've got some photographs to show you what is happening on what has been paid out already, work that has been paid out, doors that don't fit in door frames. And I'll give you these. There's an open pit that was left for months, and an old woman fell into this pit. It was left open for months.
This is work done by the
this
same agency.
This is work done by the same agency. There is, I mean, look at that slab. This is work that was paid for. Brickwork where a vent pipe was bricked up. Now, if that vent pipe is bricked up and you're going to use that toilet, you'll probably never go back there again. I can go on. I don't know who's supposed to use their toilet, Chairperson. A long, tall person that certainly is not going to fit in there. That is a completed toilet that has been paid for. Now, this is an agency that you're saying we need to give them time to get jacked up. I respectfully disagree with you, Honorable Minister, and I ask that you entertain our report and particularly our recommendation, and we're not saying that you must fire them. The recommendation says that they should be put on terms to complete its backlog for 2011 and that you seek legal advice on how to terminate their contract based on non-performance and the inability to perform. Now, as a layperson, well, perhaps I'm not a layperson being an engineer, the conditions of the contract that they've signed is enough to terminate phase 2 and 3 because they have not stuck to their part of the contract. And I'm not even touching on the amount that they've been advanced, that they should not have been advanced. It's not in the contract that they should receive money in advance. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson.
Let me assure you, I will not hesitate. I will not hesitate to stop such a contract as Minister. You know, I come from a sector where people have got to build. You want to see the results. You start building this morning, or you start producing a bar of gold. We want to see that bar leaving. And once people start fudging and you don't know what has happened, you know, in the production line, you can't have, if you're making Coca-Cola, you can't have at the end of the day from this giant company, Atlanta, this is, and 50,000 tins of Coca-Cola. But when you come, there's 10,000. Where's the other 40,000? Somebody shows you a team that is, because these teams are not complete. and drums of water and sugar that side. That's not Coca-Cola. It's dereliction of duty. Rest assured, Honorable Stay, you're not differing from me. As Minister, that's why I came here. Don't differ with me. Agree with me. I will take action. We'll shut them down. I'm not going to see a single penny of state funds going down, even if it's a state organ. What I did not want to do was to charge like a bull in a china shop with something that has just been given to me. You see, if the IDT was under this minister right now, I would know what to do. That's why I had to now interface with the minister, just changed two ministers. Now I'm talking with this other minister. Herself is already dissatisfied with this. I share this concern about the IDT. But what, from a political and a governance and professional point of view, would never do. You would have to take me up. You'll put me on a carpet. You just hear a small report and I say, I've closed this thing down. And they say, on what basis? That's why I'm here to hear all this, which you are saying. The IDT has got no future if they're going to do this type of a thing here. And you are right. People should not wait for this thing to be checked up. If I was checking it up, I know when I have to check. But you still have to talk with another department. And I don't know. I want to say also, I'm sure there are very good men and women. No, they shouldn't feel bad when they come to here as though we're just saying, and people are prepared to work. Something is blocking them there. But this lady, this chief director who's been suspended here, who came with IDT here, who came from IDT, who was in the past recommending the same IDT, which she ended up fighting, also caused the delay of the signing of these contracts. It's one of the charges which are there, caused this delay. You know, when you know that you're going to lose power and then suddenly you slow down, you start doing things and then you let the thing fail so you can justify why it should not have moved from water affairs. I don't want to get to those sub-judicate matters because that's exactly why we took action. You don't correct the wrong by doing another wrong or by breaking the law. But there's a bit more... Okay, there's a bit more to that case. I'll come to that. But I'm saying, rest assured, that if this phase ends up being what it is, and when you said 50% delivery, you're not talking human services, you're talking about the work of this company. If it's arising out of justice, if they don't satisfy us, I'll be the first person to move this contract. But can you imagine headlines saying, I just came in, something happened, push it to the private sector, find other people. Because, you know, other operators may not necessarily be in government. I think I should show responsibility here, study this thing carefully, mindful of what we are saying, that people cannot wait long for this thing. I object to a government agency that operates in this nature, no matter how many good people are inside there. Quite clearly, the management of this thing or systems or something, I don't know what, because on the other side, must be checked up. Hence, I'm sitting with that minister. And I hope next week when I come also to brief you about the energy battery thing, I'll be telling you what exactly happens in our relationship with this service provider. Please.
Just one point of clarity, Jake. I don't think we're asking for the agency to be shut down.
No, I know.
Because they're obviously involved in other services as well. And if they're good at building roads, then they must carry on building roads. But what we are saying is that they're obviously not good at providing sanitation. And quite honestly, I don't see a problem with taking that particular contract away from them and let them do the other 17 things that they perhaps, hopefully, do better than this. Thank you.
In fact, what Mr. Stein is saying, it comes from the report that we received from the National Treasury this morning to say this company has got installed in 18 departments. And in the last financial year, they received 22.6 billion from different, which means they've got much to show. So,
what does Treasury have to say? We're just having a conversation about their performance in the other day. I didn't even know that they are servicing so many of us. What does it have? Because you see, there's only so much that you can do, and not more.
And
you shouldn't find that you're writing contracts with prisons, you're taking from defense and so on, and you can't deliver on the other side. They don't have people, and then you're going to
be schools. In terms of their performance, in terms of financial performance, we understand the situation as from the first quarter and the second. We all agree about the delay. But it's amazing, also surprising. By February, they spent 11%. They have already only spent 11% by February. But by end of March, I mean the whole program spent 11% by end of February. But by end of March, 52 million of the program was spent, which means it came to 63%. So what a spike! What a spike! So it raises questions to say, those people they undertook this contract knowing very well that the time will not allow them. Why did they allow them to take the money from the government? Because that agreement should have been reworked so that it suits the 6 month or 5 month period. So they undertook that job, and now they knowing very well that they won't make it by end of the financial year to deliver the product that was agreed upon. So it raises a lot of questions to us as the people who are playing oversight on the public funds. So that is why we are recommending that at least something must be done on auditing this expenditure for this financial year to this. Otherwise, we are not fighting, but wanting to ensure that at least this cloud is cleared. And now we are getting more information, because we have to get information as the public representative. So we called National Treasury for other issues, and then said that they must brief us about this advance payment. So I say empowered, Minister. For that one, we are very much empowered. But now we're not going to talk about that. But the issue is this entity, which is saving 18, and then they received 22 billion last year. So there's too much, Mr. Honorable Bullet.
No, thank you, Chair. I also support these sentiments. Honorable Minister, we must thank you for your high spirit of humility. Minister, I think that what we can visualize and hope for is that the smooth transition from the sanitation to the Department of Human Settlements that will add value and great impetus to the delivery of sanitation. You're absolutely correct, Honorable Minister, that I know in a question that I put to your department about the NHBRC, in every area the NHBRC seems to go, there's chaos. And I strongly support your views that don't worry, you've got your hands on the pulse and you will get them all sorted out. You know, we have heard about open toilets. You hear Honorable Bowman with an open toilet with the picture. And I would assume that the Honorable Stein did not use it in the local government elections because she did not use the ones in Cape Town. But Honorable Minister, we have tremendous challenges. And if ever this local government has taught us lessons, one of the lessons that it taught me, Honorable Minister, and I want to use it as an example, we have now taken a ward from a certain political party, and within that ward, we have informal settlements. So one of the lessons that we have learned through this local government elections is the hardship that the people in the informal settlements are living. And these are the lessons that we must learn from. I want to state one particular case, Honorable Minister, and I humbly seek your intervention. And it's in the KwaZulu-Natal area, in the Amdoni municipality. If you take into consideration the safety of the 10-year Act, and you quite correctly pointed out the crude boom case in Cape Town, these people that are living in informal settlements have rights. But now that they are threatened that they will have to leave because there is a housing settlement that would not take care for the entire settlement. Now, Honorable Minister, we're speaking about sanitation, and it is absolutely the right and government to provide basic services for people that are living in a land for more than 6 months. Honorable Minister, the problem is about other basic services that they are experiencing. And I have had an in-local inspection, and it's correct for me to bring to your attention that even the mobile toilets are placed at a very, very far distance, violating their rights. But, Honorable Minister, in the final analysis, we have total faith in your impeccable leadership and your hands-on approach. And a few weeks back, your interview on TV where you delivered for a certain area, informal settlements and homes, was very, very touchy, and I have complete faith that you would continue to deliver in the best interest of the broad suffering masses. Thank you.
Minister, let's assist you on the issue you have raised. Last week we had a meeting with the department. We requested the department to brief us as you did, requesting the DT. I also SMS him, said, DT, I'm not happy about this. But we requested here the department formally, you did receive that request, to say they must come and brief us if there are any other areas that have such kind of toilet. They told us about this, as we are giving us the report, it's listed in Cape Town. But we felt that, no, there's something that is wrong with the provinces. Provinces are not honest. We had been to KZN, and we went to Amzimkhulu. I'm sure Mr. Tate took a picture where old men were sitting. In Clyde. You know, it's pathetic. We thought that the provinces are going to come out sincerely to say we do have this challenge. We are from Umfundozi at Nompumelelo. You can't believe it. One of our members, because of the type of situation people are living in. So I'm trying to say, they have to be honest with you, because you are trying to assist them that they have got a challenge of sanitation. That is not something that they can hide, because that is not their problem. It's our problem. We have to make sure that when we are tackling this issue, we are all together, we join hands, because while we are here, all of us, don't mind this passage, we are here to serve the people of this country, but the provinces are not serving. They're not honest. We requested Neville, because Neville is one of the ones. We said, Neville, go back to the department and make sure that at least you make a thorough, and we gave them the examples that they must ask those problems, what is this, what is this? Because really, they're not honest. Now, here, us all here, yourself and this public, because you are an MP. When you are standing there in the podium, whether you are executive, they're like, look at that, what is he talking about? Because people on the ground, they know that we are talking something else that is not there. So I think we are here to assist, and we appreciate what you are doing and your cooperation, and we are prepared. We always tell the DG that we are here to support, to provide leadership, even as public representatives, so that people of this country benefit. So I think we really appreciate that the issue of IDT is an issue even in the community. I've got letters, this committee has got letters from the community complaining of people, pensioners, who are paying for the digging of holes, but they were given the advance payment. So why should people dig holes, whereas these guys were given money? I've got letters, one of the municipalities in Inkandla, you can contact that councillor. He was a councillor. She was a councillor in the last term. Today she's a mayor. She's a mayor. You can contact her yourself, minister, your office, and ask about what I'm saying, because these are not form stories. People are complaining to the portfolio committee about this entity. Unfortunately, it's unfortunate that we're talking about one entity, because most of the with the others, we're not saying it's 100%, but we have not yet received so much pressure as this portfolio committee, and cannot just sit down and then. Thank you very much.
Let me also make some comments about two other things that you know, which are, even if we fix any other thing, you can have a Rolls-Royce running the implementation of that side of things in terms of sanitation. But the bigger challenge, in other words, I don't want us to have false hopes that once, because it's not within our mandate here, this IDT, I really pray and hope that Minister Mahlangu come in there and ask, because it falls under authority, will find a solution. But from an operational point of view, as Treasury says, I take what you just said, and you have been given this information this morning, a company given such a lot of work is simply not be able to carry. Simply not be able to carry. It's not feasible that they can carry. That's why you see, once you see a spike, and I'm very, very happy that once you see a spike, you start saying, because once I see a spike in expenditure, you should know there's something wrong. However, even if we get these things right, we shall have corrected only one small part, a company doing something. This bulk infrastructure is the number one problem. Please believe me, it is not IDT. That one is trying to find a job, even if it's a government thing. It is bulk infrastructure. So tomorrow, if we have no IDT and we have somebody else, will not have the same challenges. Obviously, they will have to do phases of their work properly. But the challenge of bulk infrastructure still remains. Because you need many, many billions to solve the problem of human settlements around bulk.
Yes, absolutely.
Secondly, yeah, because if you don't have that bulk, the dams, the huge pipelines, water, transportation of that water to long distances, then people cannot have these services. They'll have to wait for them for a longer time. I'm not saying it's anybody's fault. It's just that if there's not sufficient money in South Africa, there's not sufficient money. But you should be able to see some progress. There's this question of project management. And this is where the province is coming in. You see, even if there's bulk and all this, you find that people don't have capacity to appoint people to run these projects on the ground, managing these things on the ground. Project management expertise. One of the failures of municipalities is because we elect people, and believe you me, you have just come from this election. Don't think that the election is over. Brigadier Bam, you know, has done a superb job. But then you may be left on the ground with new people who don't spend money. I'm not talking about people who really steal government money. We have to do that. And you'll hear me very soon on this one, even next week. I'm talking about people who are afraid to spend because they have no capacity. Project management. They have no capacity. But they don't plan early enough. It's a headache to try to find that capacity. Towards the end of the year, they come with, you know, quick fixes, and it won't work. The last one is a social problem. Because as political leaders, now this one I want to leave with you, because you must factor it also into your thinking, particularly in relation to the informal settlements. We've got 2,700 informal settlements in this country. Just ones that you've counted, you know, with your GPS, knowing where this one is and so on. The government doesn't create them. You don't create them. Parliament doesn't create them. The economy is creating these things, and of course, history. People go out to sit, to squat, whether it's at the N2 or it's Kwabokweni or wherever, or Diepsloot. They sit there. You see, that's the challenge we're dealing with. We're dealing with a huge food cost, because International Refugees Day 2 days ago, a huge refugee problem in our own country. Because people move from parts of the country to go and sit on land that doesn't belong to them, and the courts have got to take decisions about that. They just sit there, creating a crisis of planning, strategic planning for government. There is no country that can ever be run under these conditions. Because we'll sit here, it will be words, 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 words. Whereas the truth is that people just go. And courage these days is no longer apartheid and policies. It's by dragged, okay, there are economic issues, but by nefarious and unscrupulous land barons. They deceive people, come and stay here. And people, the following day you find informal settlements. They burn these things whenever there's fire. Water visits them. Government or you, no one has put those people there. And then now, you have no plan, there's no budget for these people. And once they are there, they've taken the prime land, because people don't go and take over land somewhere else. It's all prime land. By the way, it's number one land of South Africa. So number two. Because they want to be next to where all of us are living, so that they can fulfill their own human settlements, where we live, should be, or where we can also learn, we can also love, we can also leisure, and so on. So they get close to the cities, close to the highways or railways, which is strategically a security issue, despite the fact that land is gone. Now, they create these verticals. We're actually, you know, dealing with that kind of situation. I thought we should know. It's a kind of a refugee situation in our own country, arising of historical reasons, economic questions, social questions, and in certain situations drawn by criminal syndicates who sell them land that doesn't belong to them. Therefore, suddenly you are told, come here, and there's a training of tires, demonstrations. It's not your traditional townships that are doing that. It's people who have come there. Once they are there, you know what? They have a committee overnight. And then they have placards. Because they've got placards. They've occupied somebody's land. What's the first thing they want? Sanitation. Number one. Please factor in the sanitation demand. When you see them, you can throw out sometimes as you say you are doing. You can get very angry. But just know where the problem comes from. The first demand, of course, of any human being is sanitation. But it goes hand in hand with water. They're demanding it. So imagine 2,700 informal settlements where there's more than 1.5 million people. They've decided to take this action against you. So you've got to scurry around. It doesn't matter whatever minister you can be or whatever government can be. Scurry around looking for toilets for them. Find water for them. And once it's like that, they say it's dark here. They don't lie. You have got to provide electricity. There's no bank service or anything there. Now, you see, if you can follow that pattern of reaction, you are going to have a maze of different plans that were never planned. It is just a juxtaposed situation. You can never have development like that. Therefore, also must be sensitive to that which is happening, and not treat a crisis situation as part of our planning. I just thought we should factor in that. But I want to thank you, as Chairperson, for the invitation. But I am coming next week, given this opportunity, so that you can see what it is that we are doing to get some of these corrupt activities outside our system. Again, I thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. I think we will have to attend on this one. We still have the opportunity next week. I will liaise with your office. My daughter, they know me.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you.